Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Scientists could genetically modify mosquitoes to wipe out a disease that kills hundreds of thousands of people each year. They're trying to do that with a new genetic engineering technique. They hope it will help them fight some of the world's other big problems, too. Now, there are fears about releasing insects made this way into the wild. NPR's health correspondent Rob Stein visited one of the first labs to engineer a living creature with this technology.
What you're about to hear may just sound like static at first, but if you listen closely, you can hear them. Mosquitoes. Hundreds of genetically modified mosquitoes. And not just any genetically modified mosquitoes. These are some of the first living things engineered to do something that has long been considered taboo. Spread their mutant genes fast, really fast, and as far as they can. For my close encounter with these mosquitoes, I traveled to London and found Andrew Hammond. He's a genetic engineer at Imperial College London.
Do you want me to show you at the insectary and where we do some of the work?
That'd be fabulous, thanks.
The insectary is where Hammond keeps these new mosquitoes. He leads me to a highly secure elevator and takes me down 5 floors to the basement.
Going down.
There's a few layers of security to get down here.
We pass through a series of heavy doors equipped with special blowers to push back any genetically modified mosquitoes that try to escape, before finally arriving at the insectary. Even though outside London is cold and gray, in here it's hot and humid, like the tropics, to keep the mosquitoes happy. Hammond picks up a small cage made out of white mosquito netting.
Inside this cage we've got the adult mosquitoes.
What kind of mosquitoes are these?
Everything in this cubicle is genetically modified.
They look like regular mosquitoes, but they're not. They've had something new spliced into their genes, something known as a gene drive, which is a sequence of DNA created in the lab that drives its way through the gene pool much faster than most genes. The research is funded by the Gates Foundation, which also supports NPR.
These gene drives, they're able to copy themselves. So instead of half of the offspring inheriting the gene drive, almost all of them do.
That's huge. Scientists have always tried to keep genetically engineered creatures from spreading their new DNA, to keep them from messing up the natural world. A gene drive genetic modification, it's designed to spread.
So what happens is it spreads and it spreads and it spreads. And this is the fantastic thing, because in a very short amount of time, you can actually transform an entire wild population into a modified population.
Wow.
Yeah, it's powerful.
So powerful that Hammond and his colleagues think they can use their gene-drive mosquitoes to do something humanity's been trying to do for decades, wipe out malaria. Because these mosquitoes spread mutations designed to sterilize the mosquitoes that spread the malaria parasite.
And if we sterilize the females, you can actually eliminate a whole mosquito population without affecting those mosquitoes that don't have the capability to transmit malaria. It's fantastic.
And that's just the beginning. Scientists think gene drives could let them do all sorts of things. Eradicate other diseases spread by insects, like Lyme disease and Zika. feed the world more safely by creating crops that don't need polluting pesticides, save endangered species and entire ecosystems. But critics worry gene drives are just too powerful.
It has huge implications. It's a tool that's never been in our hands before, and it is a high-risk technology.
Ricarda Steinbrecher is a scientist at the genetic watchdog group EcoNexus in Oxford, England.
You can have a collapse of ecosystems. You can have more diseases arising. You can make the whole system fragile towards climatic conditions. It basically is an unknown we are dealing with here.
Back in the lab, Andrew Hammond takes me to another area to show me how he creates gene-drive mosquitoes.
This is our micro-injection facility. So this is what we use to actually make the transgenic mosquitoes.
It's a big, dark room. Hammond sits down in front of a microscope and picks up a slide. It's got dozens of tiny black specks on it. Each speck is a mosquito embryo. Hammond lets me take a quick peek. Under the microscope, each embryo looks like a big black blob. A thin glass needle is pointing at one of the blobs.
Inside this needle is our solution that contains the DNA. And we're going to use this to modify the genome and integrate into it our gene drive.
To integrate the gene drive, Hammond's using a new DNA editing technique called CRISPR that's revolutionizing genetic engineering by making it way easier and faster. It's letting scientists like Hammond harness the power of gene drives.
That sound?
That sound is manipulating this needle into the right place.
Hammond has less than an hour to edit as many embryos as he can before they dry out.
You need to be very quick when you put the needle inside, and you need to inject just the right amount of DNA. Too much will kill it, and too little won't modify it. But if you place it in and inject, there, that's done.
And that's how you edit the DNA in a mosquito embryo.
That's right.
After they're edited, Hammond lets the embryos mature and mate with normal mosquitoes, then examines their larvae under another microscope that lights them up with a laser. The modified mosquitoes also get a marker that makes their eyes and other parts of their bodies glow if the gene drive is working.
When I look at them, if I see that half of them are red, then our gene drive is not working. But if we see that almost all of them are red, then it's definitely working.
What are you seeing?
It's definitely working.
He shows me one of the gene drive mosquito larvae magnified on a screen. It looks like something out of a horror film, like a huge radioactive worm.
We can see it glowing up in the eyes and glowing down the body. It's beautiful.
Why do you call it beautiful?
Just these incredible patterns that are formed by the neurons and the bright red fluorescence. I mean, it's a stunning image. Beautiful scientifically and beautiful visually.
But not everyone thinks this is so beautiful. Critics find it frightening. They say there's no way to know what gene-drive creatures might do if they're ever let loose. They could mutate, unleash new epidemics, cause famines. And Jim Thomas of the genetic watchdog, the Etcetera Group, says that's not all.
This potentially could be a way of creating some quite nasty bioweapons. You could engineer an insect, a stinging insect, for example, to deliver a toxin. Mosquitoes would be an obvious possible target. That would be a way that you could weaponize this technology. That certainly is of concern.
Andrew Hammond and his colleagues doubt gene drives would ever be used that way. And they argue the potential benefits are so huge that they have to try to find a way to use them safely. Molecular biologist Tony Noland is Hammond's boss.
We don't work in an ivory tower. We are fully aware of people's concerns on this. I think that we've got to weigh up the benefits whenever you consider risk. And I think that given that there are still 500,000 people dying, most of them children, from malaria, I think it's a worthwhile goal to investigate this technology.
But Nolan acknowledges that gene drives could be dangerous and be misused. So he and his colleagues are planning years of careful testing to make sure their mosquitoes are safe before they try to convince any countries to let them release them into the wild. Meanwhile, other scientists, along with the U.S. military, are trying to develop antidotes to gene drive modifications just in case one does run amok someday. Rob Stein, NPR News, London.
The student was sitting in a classroom in the high school when he wrote it.
It started on a piece of paper.
That message spread throughout the school.
and it made its way around thanks to Snapchat.
This is what the Snapchat looks like. It shows the words, "Kill all blacks," written on a piece of paper. Alongside it, what appears to be a hooded KKK member. Students feel
anger
and want
a public apology.
Tonight we talked to Kara Bruce, a member of the school's diversity club.
Our message is clear. There needs to be more cultural understanding here at Piper High School. Enough is enough. There needs to be more done.
Her father wants the student who did it to get checked out by professionals.
And make sure that they're not a threat to themselves or to any of the students in the school.
The school district emailed a letter to parents today notifying them about the incident. The high school principal said appropriate consequences will be enforced. Sophomore L.J. Brown says the incident hurts, but he says he's not surprised it happened.
It's really upsetting. And a lot of things like this have happened. It just hasn't got out.
Students say that Snapchat quickly became the talk of school.
They felt as though putting that out, I would assume, would cause more of an issue, which it did. It did cause an issue as it's been circulating through Facebook.
Tonight, District Superintendent Tim Conrad issued Fox 4's statement saying the district has a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to discrimination. He said the safety of students is a top priority and actions like this won't be tolerated. LJ says all he wants to hear from the student who wrote it is, "I'm sorry."
Everybody serves a second chance. I would definitely accept his apology.
The superintendent would not tell us what kind of punishment that student will face, citing privacy concerns. Molly Balkenbush, Fox 4 News, working for you in Kansas City, Kansas.
Parents taking action by taking over an entire school board meeting.
And diversify this board to represent us. That's what I said. To be clear.
The parents are furious with how the district dealt with a teacher accused of making racist comments in class.
Now new at 10, 41 Action News reporter Tom Dempsey is live in Lawrence where police even showed up. Tom.
Yeah, that's right, guys. 3 hours after the Board of Education meeting began, this sit-in with parents continues here at the Lawrence Public Schools building. This all revolves around a settlement that was reached between the Board of Education and a teacher that this is outlined in this summary that you see right here, and this is all the outrage that's over right now.
The main points that I want to talk to tonight.
Tonight's school board meeting in Lawrence quickly turned into chaos.
Y'all sit here and protected Mr. Cobb.
Dozens of parents fed up with the school board after members reached a settlement with a teacher at South Middle School, accused of making racist comments to students, allowing information from his case to be kept secret. Monique Richardson helped organize tonight's protest. She says her son heard some of the alleged racist comments in class.
That whites are superior to blacks, that because of the color of my skin, that I'll never make the amount of money that any other race makes.
The settlement allows the teacher to resign at the end of the school year while continuing to get paid. The frustration from the community spilled into the halls.
That's another
advisory group. No, advisory group.
Board members put in the spotlight for their decision to approve the settlement.
Obviously, we have some pretty upset individuals, and I think some of us justified, and as board members, we're going to try to listen and move forward.
Parents identify the teacher as Chris Cobb. Tonight, 41 Action News stopped by his home for comment.
You are?
Tom Dempsey. I'm a reporter with 41 Action News.
Instead, he gave us this statement of his resignation, saying he has been unjustly accused of making racially insensitive remarks in the classroom. With his resignation set for the end of the school year, parents say the fight to overturn the settlement will continue.
We're not going to sit down and lay down. These are our children.
It's unknown if or when this sit-in will end tonight. We did ask the superintendent for comment, but he declined to comment for this story. Parents say they do plan to continue protesting at future Board of Education meetings. Live in Lawrence, I'm Tom Dempsey, 41 Action News.
You know,
There's a lovely, sad Negro spiritual. Ivy's brother used to sing this when he came in from the tobacco fields. Mama, is Master gonna sell us tomorrow? Yes. Yes, yes.
A Howard County high school teacher under fire tonight after a controversial assignment some are calling racially insensitive. It is the latest example of tension in that school system. WJZ is live. Devin Bartolotta explains the teacher was not disciplined. Devin?
Mary, the Howard County school superintendent tells our media partner, the Baltimore Sun, that teacher is inexperienced and the assignment outrageous. Making light of Black history, that's what one Mount Hebron teacher is accused of. Assigning 11th grade students to write songs about slavery, saying, quote, have fun and entertain us all.
My insensitivity barometer hit 10.
Former school board member Larry Walker says the district lacks guidance on diversity issues, but the teacher should not lose her job.
I think this was just a teacher who had a blind spot. And from my investigation, was well-intentioned in the lesson.
The teacher in this case was placed on administrative leave, not a disciplinary action, the district says.
There's been lots of similar incidents at Hebron towards like racism and stuff, and I think that this is just another thing that like contributes.
Just last week, Oakland Mills High School students walked out over racial tensions in the school. And in February, a racist rant from a Mount Hebron student went viral.
Cares about some black man.
Now this poorly worded assignment has taken center stage.
Other teachers in the past years have done it before, and this is really the only time anybody's gotten in trouble for it.
Is this kind of assignment acceptable in this district?
So it's never acceptable to offend students or adults, and we just want to make sure that that doesn't occur even by accident.
The district now promising it won't happen again. The assignment was removed. The teacher was back in the classroom yesterday. Reporting live tonight, Devin Bartolotta, WJZ Eyewitness News.
Devin, thank you. The school principal sent out an email to parents inviting them to a school meeting to discuss the topic.
I'm not sure anymore just how it happened before. The places that I knew were sunny and blue. I can feel it deep inside, this black nigger's pride. I have no fear when I say, and I say it every day, every nigger is a star.
The writing on the door, once I open the door.
The words are gone, but more paint can't erase the hurt or the fear.
When the officers left, and I closed the door, I honestly just fell down and fell to the ground and was bawling like a little baby, because that has never happened to me before.
This man doesn't want us to identify him because he's scared the criminals will come back.
Not just the writing, but they left a note, and the note was really scary, because it makes it feel like it's not just a bunch of kids playing around, like, watch your back.
The vandals struck in November, taking two doors in this apartment complex. And now they're back, leaving threats on three more. They're targeting black residents and interracial couples.
It says, you know, KKK, and then it says the N-word.
Katie Reed worries about her husband and herself.
This has gone a little too far now that people are feeling unsafe and, you know, threatened in their own home.
Then they had the maintenance to come spray over it so that you couldn't see the racial slurs.
But Daniel Harrison says he's not intimidated.
Because I'm not afraid of racial slurs. It's 2016 and we still can't get along. That's really, that's their problem.
But while it's easy for Harrison to move on, for others,
it's got me very concerned and worried.
It'll take a long time to forget. Residents hope that maintenance does more than just spray paint the white on that door, because they say it is a constant reminder that they were targeted. We did contact the apartment complex, but we did not hear back as of tonight. Live in Aurora, Emily Allen, Fox 31.
Every nigga is a star. Every nigga
is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
A firefighter fired from his job with the Belden Department after officials say he went on a racist rant on someone else's Facebook post over the weekend. Fox 15's Cassandra Arsenault live in the newsroom now after talking with the fire chief there and the woman who says that she was on the other end of that rant, Cassie.
Well, Josh, the fire chief tells me that racist remarks like the one you're about to hear about have to be dealt with quickly, especially because when it's time to do their job, there's no room for discrimination.
A three-sentence statement was all it took to get Ryan Hudson fired. But those small sentences were loaded with vulgar and inappropriate language that could only be described as racist. The woman who those comments were allegedly directed at didn't want to be identified. She told Fox 17 this all started after she commented on a status about Colin Kaepernick taking a knee during the national anthem. She says she agrees with his right to do so and says it was that comment that led to a back and forth with Hudson.
Then he decided to call me
nigga!
Kick his and all kinds of other stuff. Oh, that I should go back to the fields from whence he saved me from. Nowhere are you a public servant and you're in a public forum speaking like this. In no way is it okay. Because now he's claiming that he was drunk. First he was hacked, then he was drunk.
Her screenshot of Hudson's comments came to his boss's attention not too long after.
One of my firemen came into the station and said, Chief, you need to take a look at this.
Chief Greg Moore of the Belding Fire Department said Ryan Hudson had been with the department, or the family, as he likes to call it, for a year, and had never showed signs of ever saying or thinking something like this.
We never see things like this from our family. We're all there to help people, and something like this is a shock, and you go, this is a huge hurt to us. It hurt when I read it.
Chief Moore says he immediately called his union representative and the city manager to tell them he was thinking of firing Hudson. They all agreed that was for the best.
I've actually never had to fire someone. This was a first. I mean, my employees are excellent employees. They do what they're supposed to do, and this was so out of the ordinary for a firefighter to do.
And the woman that Hudson said these horrible things to said it's not just about hurting her feelings.
Yes, we do have free speech in this country, but free speech does not mean you are saved from the consequences of your free speech and your decisions. We don't get to just spout off at the mouth and spew hatred and ignorance.
Chief Moore agrees. He said the reason for the immediate action is simple. When the red siren goes off for them to hit the road and possibly save lives, there cannot be any question that his men will do their job no matter what color the skin of a person is.
You know, we don't know that that would have changed any of his thought, you know, on what he would do, but we can't take the chance. We have to treat everybody equal no matter what, and we want that to happen.
Now, we did reach out to Hudson for comment. He has not gotten back to us as of news time. In the newsroom, Cassandra Arsenault, Fox 17 News.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
New at 6, an update to a story we first told you about last month. This all started with a controversial Facebook post by a woman in charge of the Clay County Development Corporation. Pamela Taylor's remark about the First Lady, Michelle Obama, went viral, leading to people from all over the world calling for her to be fired. And the mayor then, who commented on her post to go with her. Well, the mayor resigned a few days later, and Taylor was put on leave. News Channel 3's Jatera McGee explains that now the state is getting involved.
What started as just a Facebook status has brought international attention to a small town in Clay County. The woman at the center of that controversial post is expected to be back in the office. And as people around the country and the world demanded action, the state is stepping in.
You know, when you go into it, you don't want any discrimination or anything else.
In a statement 1 month after the original post, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin says The state of West Virginia vehemently opposes any discriminatory and harassing sentiments, language, or actions. As a result of recent comments made by the corporation's director, Ms. Pamela Taylor, we have been and continue to review those contracts to determine any alternatives the state might have. While it's not a state agency, two state agencies have contracts with the Clay Development Corporation. The Bureau for Senior Services grants them approximately $360,000 annually. But Governor Tomlin says if Taylor's comments violated the non-discrimination clauses, both contracts may be coming to an end.
Obviously, you know, what we're asking the agency to do up there is to look back at the the contents of their contract with the state of West Virginia. And if they're not following what the contract says, absolutely, the contract could be pulled.
A board of directors resides over the Clay County Development Corporation and decides if Pamela Taylor will be brought back to the job. I went to board president Eunice Thomas's home to talk to her in person. She declined to go on camera, but told me that contrary to recent reports, Taylor has not been reinstated. However, that is the plan. Thomas tells WSAZ the source of the controversy is Facebook, but admits she doesn't even have the internet or a full grasp of Facebook. Thomas says for now, Taylor remains on a 90-day leave, but told me she did not know whether leave was paid or unpaid. She says the corporation is sorting through their contracts with the state and plans to respond to the letter soon. Jatera McGee, WSAZ News Channel 3, Clay County.
All right, thanks, Jatera. The governor's office says the Clay County Development Corporation has 30 days to respond to their letter. Governor Tomlin also says that before any contracts are suspended, the state will need to determine how to help the seniors that the Clay-based corporation currently assists.
I'm sorry, so sorry.
Welcome back to Eyewitness News. An emotional apology today inside a Cumberland County courtroom. Our cameras were rolling when a man accused of punching a protester at a Donald Trump rally apologized to that protester, and the two men embraced. Morgan Norwood was in the courtroom.
A moment of peace today in a case that made national headlines. What began with a plea of no contest ended with an apology, tears, and a hope for healing. John McGraw pleaded no contest this morning to misdemeanor battery, assault, and disorderly conduct for that March attack. The defense insisted that the judge exercise leniency in sentencing, adding that McGraw didn't punch Rakeem Jones out of hatred or race. While Jones agreed, he said that he still didn't think it was right, referencing a case where his friend was given 5 years for similar brawl. The district court judge gave both men the opportunity to talk it out face-to-face, McGraw issuing a jaw-dropping apology to Jones, telling him that their responsibility is to heal the nation. Though that moment ended in applause from the courtroom, Jones tells us that the embrace was personal and sincere.
I wouldn't do it for a clap, to be honest. I would have did it the same thing had it just been me and him standing there by ourselves. It was just a real moment, I guess, everybody seen it, and it wasn't for them, it was for us.
McGraw will be put on unsupervised probation for the next 12 months. In Fayetteville, I'm Morgan Norwood, ABC 11 Eyewitness News.
Trump went to go see Obama last week, you see that? Yeah, did you see Trump's face when he came out the meeting? Trump got sunned. He looked shook. Trump looked like he got shook. He probably came in there, hi, how are you, Mr. President? Good to see you. Hello, Donald. How you feeling? Oh, God, I got to tell you, this job looks like it's going to be a lot harder than I thought. Really? It's not that hard. I mean, at least you get to be white while you're doing it.
Author Ta-Nehisi Coates was probably always planning on writing a big piece around this time of year, a big picture philosophical analysis about what it meant for this country to be led by a black president for 8 years, and what that president's legacy would be. After the election of Donald Trump, that legacy was no longer secure, and Ta-Nehisi Coates started thinking about the Obama years in a different way. His new piece in The Atlantic is called My President Was Black: A History of the First African-American White House and of What Came Next. Coates told me that in some ways, Barack Obama was naive about the role race would play in his presidency and the election of Donald Trump.
I think President Obama deeply underestimated the force of white supremacy in American life. I want to be really, really clear about this. It does not mean that everyone or even the majority of people who voted for Donald Trump are racist or white supremacists or anything like that. But what it means is that it's not a mistake that Trump began his campaign with birtherism. That's not an accident that he didn't begin with, say, trade or jobs or anything. That he actually began by otherizing the first African-American president of the United States. And from that, you know, went on to, you know, otherize Muslims, otherize Latinos, otherize women, you know, that he built out from that. And it can be true that a unique, you know, individual like Barack Obama can succeed in spite of that and still be the case that that force is quite, quite strong.
Is his misreading, as you say, of the power of certain racist tendencies in our culture, how much of that had to do with who Barack Obama is at his core? You say he is an unfailing optimist.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of, you know, very thin way of reading this that says, well, Barack Obama is biracial, thus that gives him some understanding of both white America and black America. But that's not really it. What it is that Barack Obama was raised by a white mother and two white grandparents who, A, told him he was black and that there was nothing wrong with being black. He grew up in Hawaii, far, far removed from the most, you know, sort of violent, you know, tendencies of Jim Crow and segregation. He wasn't directly exposed to that. He was untraumatized. And so that gave him a kind of optimism, an ability to see things, you know, and frankly, an ability to trust, you know, in his fellow, you know, white countrymen in a way that I, for instance, you know, and the vast majority of black people that I know never really could. At the same time, I think that ultimately led him to underestimate some of the difficulties that he would face.
Was the big achievement just winning the White House?
No, that was an achievement. But as an African-American, I think the symbolism is in how he conducted himself. The symbolism was in, and this sounds really, really small, but it's actually big for African-Americans. The symbolism was not in being an embarrassment, but to being a figure that folks were actually proud of.
At the same time, you've been critical of the president.
I have, yes.
In particular, in how he has directed what you could describe as patronizing remarks to African-American communities.
Yeah, I think so. You know, part of that is ordinary African-Americans, you know, you come out of your house and you see the conditions in your neighborhood and you see, you know, folks in your neighborhood doing certain things that, you know, are irresponsible. You know, the thing I always think about, you get up early in the morning, go to work, and there's, you know, some dude outside drinking, and you come home and that same dude is outside drinking, hanging on the corner. And then this engenders a level of anger, I think, and you know, and a level of shame. You know, my mom used to tell me, you know, I can't use this phrase on the radio, but basically don't be one of those dudes hanging on the corner. And I think the president adopted some of that same language, but took it into the White House. And I think, like, there's a crucial difference between being, you know, Joe Schmo in the neighborhood and being the head, you know, of the government that, you know, in many ways is largely responsible for those conditions in the first place.
According to the most recent exit polling, 8% of African-Americans voted for Donald Trump. Mm. For those African-Americans who voted for Donald Trump, were they disavowing the presidency of Barack Obama and his legacy?
I don't know, but I would flip this the other way and say over 90% of African-Americans voted against Donald Trump. Anytime you have, you know, upwards of 90% of a demographic voting against somebody, that's a statement.
What was your most recent conversation with Barack Obama like?
It was a week after Donald Trump had won. And initially, he was still optimistic. He felt that things would be okay, ultimately. And I have to tell you, this is the area where, you know, I see, you know, some degree of contradiction. I mean, the president, you know, at one point when he was campaigning, said, I believe that Donald Trump was not qualified to run a 7-Eleven. I don't know how you bridge that contradiction, but I felt that he was sincere. I didn't feel like a line to me. It felt like him reverting back to what was in his bones, and that's, you know, optimism and a deep belief in, you know, American institutions and the American people.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His cover story, My President Was Black, is out today. Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All my black friends,
who have money said the same thing when Trump got elected. That's it, bro. I'm out. I'm leaving the country. You coming with us? Nah, I'm good, dog. I'm gonna stay here and get this tax break, see how it works out.
Now, if President Obama reflects on race in America today, President-elect Trump, he met with African-American leaders in New York City to talk about issues that impact their community. Joining us now to discuss those meetings are two men who attended it. He's an executive committee member on Trump's transition team, the Reverend Darrell Scott from Cleveland, and he's a Hall of Fame NFL legend, the one and only Jim Brown. Last night, Jim received the Sports Illustrated Muhammad Ali Legacy Award. You know, I got gloves up in my office that Muhammad Ali signed and sent to me.
Well, he must really like you.
By the way, so hold up your hands. Okay. Look at his right hand. Pan in on his right hand. No, that's the left hand. Your right one. Yeah.
Well, it's both.
No, show him the pinky. Look at the pinky. Look at how those hands. Is that all from football?
Yes.
Man, did you bust them like 20 times each?
Hey, look, I was busting something else, too. I was just getting busted.
You know, Pastor, you and I have been friends now. We've become friends over this campaign. I had the honor of hanging out with you last night, and we're talking religion and politics. We're having a good time. But we also spent a lot of time talking about the black community. And one of the things I suggest, and I know Donald Trump's talked about it because I've talked to him about it, and you have. So if we're going to take in $3 trillion repatriated money from multinational corporations at 10%. Why don't we lower it to 5 or 6 and tell those companies to invest in your city of Cleveland, in Milwaukee, in Detroit, and Philadelphia? If you add to that education sent back to the communities and choice and competition for those dollars, because top-down education isn't working and inner-city schools have been impacted negatively the worst, wouldn't that help go a long way to showing that government can help the black community?
Absolutely. I mean, we felt disconnected by the government. We felt disconnected by whatever presidential administrations. It seems like we're forgotten people, a forgotten race. And we
every
feel
4 years, they come calling for votes.
Right. And right now, you know, especially during this last election, we presented a picture of oppression. That, you know, we even referred to whites as the oppressor. And so that puts a mentality that needs to be dealt with before we can make some positive change.
What do you think when Obama says that America by no means has overcome the legacies of slavery, Jim Crow, colonialism, racism, and that those who favor welfare cuts are racist? What is he talking about? Well, this country elected him in massive numbers.
Yeah, well, once again, that speaks to the mindset. I mean, welfare should never be a goal. Welfare was meant to be assistance until you were able to make a positive change in your life. It was never supposed to be a lifestyle. We should never have second, third, fourth, fifth generation welfare recipients in America of any nationality.
Jim Brown, if Donald Trump follows up and brings economic development specifically into inner city America that needs it the most, if he gives parents whose kids have been suffering in inferior schools the choice to send them to more competitive schools, would that go a long way to getting away from this, I guess, the 90% of black America that always votes Democrat?
That's a very tricky
statement. That's not a tricky question. That's an easy question.
Well, I tell you, naturally, let me put it this way. The president-elect have already said that he's in. We made a presentation to him about economic development in the black community, about families, about the state of our black communities in this country. And he realizes that with the education and the attack on the violence that takes place, that we can then get on the right track with our economic development.
Did you walk out of that meeting confident today that he's going to follow up?
Oh, absolutely. He's not a phony.
He's not.
He's not a phony. He agreed that we can work together.
Can I
ask
you?
We're coming to bring him something, and through this young gentleman, the pastor here, we've been able to come and be on your show tonight as a unified threesome.
If you look at polls along racial lines, America's never been more divided. Obama leaves after 8 years saying We haven't overcome slavery, Jim Crow, colonialism, racism, and if you want a welfare cut, you're racist. Really? Every 4 years, as a conservative, I resent the Democratic Party playing the race card. I look at a president that saw, during his presidency, 4,000 dead people in his home city, 3,000 shot this year, and he didn't lift a finger, Pastor.
Chicago.
Not a finger.
Well, one of the reasons we had our meeting with the president-elect today is, you know, Jim Brown has a program that's been very effective over the years that can address this situation. Now, Mr. Trump made promises to the African-American community. What do you have to lose? Give me a chance. And rather than we sit down with intelligentsia and try to rely on statistics to try to address the affairs or the problems of the African-American community, Jim Brown already has a model. He already has a vehicle that's very, very effective in 99% of that which we need to address. And so my thing is, let's get it to the table. Let's get this administration, let's get the country behind it. Put some gas in the vehicle, and we can ride this thing into a promised land.
All right. So if we go energy independent, if he's able to incentivize companies to build in Detroit, Cleveland, Philly, and all over the country, cities that need it, Milwaukee, then let's have some ribbon cuttings. Let's get some people hired. Let's fix the schools. And I say a lot of your problems go away. You agree?
Absolutely.
So I should be president.
But here's the deal.
What?
You're talking about it. This is your job to talk. We have to go out and implement it.
No, I'm not just talking.
But this is a tremendous... Well, okay, then you're part of it. But this is the beginning...
All right.
...of a different attitude. Because this young man has positioned the president in a position that he will be able to utilize so many of our great athletes and our great entertainers.
To help. You know, here
That's
it is.
Right, to help.
But the best part is, he's talking to you now after he won.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
So that to me is a good sign.
And you know what?
By the way, do you still want me to preach at the pulpit in your
January
church?
15th.
But he's preaching right now.
Yeah, I am not preaching right now. What do you mean I'm preaching right now?
January 15th.
Listen, you have your own idea about it, which is good.
Here's what I believe. I believe that every child is a child of God. This is my message. Education means to bring forth from within, and we have destroyed so much talent of young people because we have not fed and given them the water and the light that they need to grow into what they could be, what God created them to be.
We are sitting here.
Yeah, I know. To help.
Yes.
That's why I invited you.
Thank you.
Again, everything has to be put in the context of a power dynamic system of racism and white supremacy. That's one thing the president spoke of, looking at behavior in context. Now, whether he actually meant context as I say it, I say the context is a system of racism and white supremacy.
You said cuck. Do you know what that means? It's the new insult on the internet.
A cuck?
Yes.
C-U-K?
C-U-C-K.
This is podcaster and provocateur Joe Rogan, introducing his guest to the word cuck. It's a shortening of the ancient insult cuckold. You know that word for a man being cheated on by his wife. Now, many modern insults already exist to emasculate men. There's wussy and pussy, but white nationalists have taken hold of this new old word and twisted the meaning to slander men, quote-unquote, cheating on the white race.
A cuck is someone who's a wimpy male, and it started out with cuckservative. It started out pretty interesting. It was, let's make fun of the GOP for being open borders.
Gavin McInnes there explaining the meaning of the portmanteau, cuckservative, on Glenn Beck's show The Blaze. Cuck and cuckservative first gained traction in the underbelly of the internet, showing up on sites like 4chan and then popping up in more mainstream spaces like Twitter and YouTube before catching fire first in the conservative press.
And it was a nice attack on George W. Bush, on Rubio, on Jeb Bush, the Bushes in general.
Right.
And I thought, I love this now. But then next thing you know, you're a cuckservative if you're a race mixer, like Nick Searcy was getting in trouble for adopting a black kid. Or you're a cuckservative if you're Ezra Levant and you're Jewish and you don't hate Israel. That's when I had to go, whoa, whoa, guys. It's sort of like the black stuff that gets on Spider-Man and then he turns into Venom.
Yes.
You got to be careful with it.
Suddenly, the slur that was being used in a very targeted way against moderate Republicans morphed into an insult being hurled against nearly anyone opposed to white nationalist ideology. The mainstream media, anyone opposing Trump, two actors from the hit TV show Silicon Valley. The week after the election, actor Kumail Nanjiani from Silicon Valley tweeted out this, quote, "Was at a bar last night with Thomas Middleditch. At the end of the night, two white dudes, 20s, who had been there for hours, came up to us. We're a big fan of you guys. To Thomas, I trolled you on Twitter yesterday. He goes on to say how we're wrong about Trump. I go, hey, we're not here to discuss politics right now. His friend goes, oh, they're cucks. Then started yelling at us, cucks, cucks, cucks. He starts getting in my face. Thomas puts his hand on the dude's chest to stop him. Don't touch me, you cuck. Want to go outside? At this point, the bouncer runs over, grabs them, kicks them out. The bartender is awesome and apologetic. Thomas and I are stunned." Thomas Middleditch, the other actor from Silicon Valley, tweeted to confirm Kumail's story, which all doesn't make much sense. Kumail is an immigrant to the U.S., the very group that white nationalists and white supremacists claim to be cuckolding white America. So how can Kumail be a cuck? Maybe it's because he's a successful celebrity. Confusing. But words aren't fixed in place. Meaning is constantly shifting. Could we be witnessing the evolution of a slur? Let's go back to the beginning.
It has to do with stealing someone else's eggs.
Michael Adams is a professor of language and literature at Indiana University, Bloomington. He studies slang. He recently wrote a book called In Praise of Profanity, and he's talking about the cuckoo bird. The word cuckold can be traced back to this sneaky little bird that lays their eggs in another bird species' nest.
Cuckold is an older word. You can take it all the way back to the 13th century, and it's always had a pejorative sense because the assumption was that, once you were married, you were supposed to remain faithful to a spouse. And it's always been a derisive term because men should be able to govern their women. I'm not saying that as a matter of fact today. I'm saying that as a historical assumption. And so if you were old and feeble, or if you were unattractive, or if you were inattentive, or if you were dumb as a rock or not sexually attractive, and your wife went off to be with another man, then that really underscored your deficiency as a man.
And the shortened word cuck also goes back centuries, says Adams.
Even in the 16th century, cuck was seen as a word part that you could combine with another word like queen. So you had cuck queens, who were women who had unfaithful husbands. It worked both ways. So I guess you could say people have seen the potential in cuck as a word for a while. You know, it serves the same purpose that cuckold could serve, but it's just a more effective word, I think, not least because, frankly, it rhymes with the F word. So it carries potentially in the ear a lot of negative meaning.
There's something interesting about curse words. Cuck sounds, it sounds, when you actually say it, it's got the hard C and the hard K.
Sure.
And it sounds bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, does sound play into how words go viral or how bad words get formed, made, et
yeah,
cetera?
No, it definitely does. It's difficult to think of it this way, but when you're speaking, you're really gesturing inside of your mouth, and there's striking, and there's spitting, and there are some pretty fundamental things going on that I guess you could put in the range of violent behavior, even though it's all happening in your mouth rather than out at your fists. And so you get the right vowel in between a consonant like K. And, I mean, cook doesn't sound so terrible, does it? And squeak doesn't sound so terrible. But if you get a short vowel in between those two Ks, then it emphasizes the striking sound. And we do tend to use words that have that type of sound as our profanities. The F word is another example of it. Probably you get more excellent profanity out of starting with what a linguist calls a fricative, a sound, a consonant, where you're letting air pass through the mouth, not where you're stopping the airflow. So allows you to sort of build up a head of steam with which to strike the k at the end of the word. But starting with a k and ending with a k works pretty well too.
I was thinking a lot about, like, why not pussy or why not wussy, why cuck took hold. And I was just thinking about how pussy, it has the same meaning as cuck in essence, but also it's like a feminine word, and
right,
cuck is masculine word, and like what the difference
if there's something to that as
yeah,
well.
It's two different types of demeaning. I've thought about that too. I have the two words side by side on a sheet of paper, looking at them, thinking, really, what is the difference? And they can both be used to mean ineffectual male, but one says the male is ineffectual because he's like a woman, and the other says he's ineffectual because he can't stand up for himself. And that seems to be the meaning that's politically relevant in the alt-right, that cucks and being cucked, you're not able to exercise your masculinity in the way that you ought to, and you're taken advantage of as a result of that. And pussy and wussy don't necessarily imply that you're being taken advantage of. So I think that there is a difference in meaning there. But I also think, frankly, that I don't want to say something that isn't really true, I guess. I'm not trying to say that alt-righters are necessarily violent, but there's a violence in cuck compared to pussy, which is a relatively soft word in its sound, or wussy. There's a meaning behind that sound, too.
There is a violence to the sound of the word cuck, and it sounds at times like a cross between fuck and one of the C words, either cock or cunt. So where did the alt-right rediscover this term? Where did they get it from?
It's recently been used in some surprising niches in video game play, in the BDSM world, bondage, domination, sadomasochism. And so I was kind of surprised when it popped up in alt-right speak, because I wondered, you know, how many of the alt-right people were involved in BDSM activities or visiting BDSM websites where they were picking up on this word. So the entry of the word into the alt-right has been a little bit mysterious to me, and I haven't been able to pin it down yet myself.
If the alt-right slur cuck has any roots in the world of BDSM and kink/fetish circles, I knew who I needed to talk with.
I'm Dan Savage, and I write Savage Love. It's a internationally syndicated sex advice column, and I've been writing about cuckolds and cuckolding for almost as long as I've been writing about sex.
If you've never listened to Dan Savage's Lovecast, I fully permit you to stop this podcast right now and download it and listen. I start off by asking Dan when he first encountered the word cuckold.
I have a theater background, so I heard about it reading The Merry Wives of Windsor by William Shakespeare. So I was familiar with the term for a long time, but it was only about 10, 15 years ago that it was adopted and popularized by a certain kind of kinkster, a guy who is at once jealous and threatened, but also aroused and turned on by his usually female partner or wife cheating on him, often in front of him. And in many instances, although not all instances, and I would say probably not a majority of instances, there's a racial element to it. The sort of first publicly self-identified cuckolds we heard from and about in articles in, I believe, Nylon or Vice, were about guys in the South who were having parties to get together their wives with black guys and watch their wives have sex with black guys. And in interviewing these guys, they were racists often, but this was their kink and this was their turn-on.
So is the term, as it first came into kink, is it pejorative? Because so Shakespeare, it's a pejorative term. Did it have a pejorative sense when it came into kink?
Cuckolding, as distinct from hotwifing, which is where someone enjoys sharing his hot wife or hot partner with someone else without any element of humiliation or degradation, cuckolding involves humiliation. So appropriating or choosing a word that historically had been an insult made sense for the fetish, because the fetish is about the cuckolding thing specifically, as opposed to hot wiping, is about the degradation, about the humiliation, about the eroticized feelings of inadequacy, and really leaning into those. So it makes total sense that cuckolds chose, as a self-identifying term, chose to embrace this word that for centuries had been an insult, because cuckolding involves the insult, the eroticized insult of your partner cheating on you.
That's really interesting. And when you say there's a racialized aspect of the first cuckolding that you saw, I mean, how does the sex positive community look upon this kind of activity or this sort of portion of the cuckolding?
In the kink community, there are different kinds of racialized play. And there's all sorts of fears and taboos that are explored through kink and through play. There are people who have rape fantasies, and It's possible to enact those without raping anyone. It's possible to engage in kinks and indulge kinks that involve sort of eroticized racial aspects without succumbing to racism, without being racist. You just have to be thoughtful about it. So I don't think that people in the kink community necessarily had a problem with cuckolding when it emerged and became more public and publicly known for that element of it, because there were other elements of race play in the kink community and other elements of taboo and transgressive play in the kink community. And a distinction is made between what's eroticized, and it's often fears that are eroticized, and what then is politically expressed or socially expressed. And those are different categories with different impacts. If you dink around on cuckold subreddits or you look at cuckold porn, a minority of it features race play.
It's like a small minor subset of the whole kink that is race play.
Exactly. The first sort of high profile conversations about it, I believe that it was in Atlantic Monthly many years ago. There's a big splashy story about cuckolds, and guys were calling themselves cuckolds, and it was all about race, and it was in the South, and these were guys with racist views who got off on their wives having sex with quote unquote black bucks. And so, you know, when it first burst into the public consciousness, there was this racial element. But as the kink has sort of become more popularized and awareness of it, I don't think kinks are contagious myself, you know, but as awareness of it has grown and more people have been able to go, oh, there's a name for this thing that's always turned me on. That's what I am. I think there's less and less of a racial dynamic at play. You know, you look at those subreddits. There's also one called r/cuckold community. And very rarely is it about race, that you see people bragging about the men that their wives are sleeping with. And they'll even post videos. And, you know, the guy who's sleeping with the guy's wife is white too, or Asian or Latin. And it's not about black bucks, quote unquote.
Is that sort of aspect of it completely American?
Yeah, it does seem to be not a completely, but I think a more common fetish here among Americans. My column runs in Italy and it runs in China, and I don't get a lot of letters from Italy about cuckolding. But I get a letter every day or so from an American about cuckolding.
And I wonder how much race plays into that.
I think race plays a part in it for many people. I think the importance that we put on monogamy in this country drives it in a huge way here. You know, why don't I get these questions from Italy? Why don't I hear about this in France? Well, they place much less emphasis on monogamy as the defining sort of stand-in talismanic evidence of like a good and solid and loving relationship. We place so much emphasis on monogamy that, of course, then some people are going to eroticize transgressing against the monogamous ideal.
Everybody's cuckolding in Italy. That's
everybody's cheating. I mean, they take a much more laissez-faire attitude, and I think a much healthier one if you're concerned about the survival of marriages and relationships, that an infidelity can happen, and maybe it's something that you can get past, not something to celebrate, but certainly not a good reason all by itself to end a marriage and break up a family. You know, here where we frame infidelity as always and inevitably a relationship ender and a marriage ender, then the fear of it, the fear of infidelity, the paranoia about it is going to be so much greater. And a certain small number of people, whatever there is that people are terribly, terribly afraid of, particularly if it intersects with genitalia in any way, a certain small number of people are going to eroticize that fear and run toward it instead of running from it.
So seeing how this word has been taken hold by white supremacists, white nationalists, the so-called alt-right, what have your thoughts been since seeing the word kind of pop into their lexicon?
Well, the way the alt-right uses the word, or the white nationalist, racist, xenophobic, anti-Semitic right uses the word, is galling and insulting, because they're sort of reappropriating it from the cuckold community that popularized it. And instead of meaning, you know, someone who in a consensual way enjoys exploring these taboos and these kinks and these eroticized fears with mutually consenting adult partners, the alt-right uses it to mean race traitor, that this is someone who has been sexually humiliated or whose politics, in a sense, sexually humiliate them because they care about people of color, because they care about racial justice. And when you see the term used at places like Breitbart, all over the comments, it's not used to describe someone who's got a kink or got a fetish. It's used to describe and dismiss and shame and heap stigma on someone who supports affirmative action, who supports a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, who believes that Black Lives Matter, who believes that we have a police brutality problem in this country. And it's a way of attacking someone and calling someone out who's white and accusing them of betraying other white people by supporting justice for all races in this country. It's very toxic. And that there's this element of sexualized degradation and humiliation in the use of the term among the alt-right makes it more potentially damaging and humiliating for some people.
It's a very, very insidious word in the way that they've been using it. And it has become sort of devoid of its original meaning in so many ways.
It doesn't make sense. You know, originally the term meant a husband who'd been cheated on by his wife. And, you know, it got around. He was found out. They were found out. And he was publicly humiliated, publicly shamed because he couldn't control his wife. Then, you know, this kink community embraced the term and it meant a guy who got off on being cheated on by his wife. And this was something they did together and enjoyed together. And it was no longer humiliating, although humiliating was a part of the play. It was consensual and joyful. And it's just been stolen out from under them to mean race traitor. That's what the alt-right means when they slap a cuck label on someone, a traitor to the white race, which is not actually a thing, the white race. There is no white race. It's more known now in that sense than in the kink sense or indeed the Shakespearean sense. So you needed a new term, and they seized on this one that goes more to the heart of their mission, which is not about sexual orientation necessarily. It's about stirring up racial animus and tapping into racial hatreds for political gain and economic gain. Racism and sex negativity and hate, that's what they're doing with that word on the alt racist right.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and 8 others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways. God has different ideas.
Right now, a live look at the federal courthouse in downtown Charleston. Testimony from the lead FBI agent in the case still underway in the fifth day of the federal death penalty trial of Dylan Roof.
Roof is accused of killing 9 people last year at Mother Emanuel AME in downtown Charleston. We have live team coverage this afternoon.
Lisa Weissman live outside the federal courthouse. Lisa, new evidence shows Roof may have had his sights set on Mother Emanuel AME Church for quite some time.
Bill, based on the GPS found inside of Roof's car, that could very well be the case. Of course, Roof lives in Columbia with his mother. It's where his father and his mother both live. He lives at his mother's boyfriend's house. So a representative from the GPS company Garmin took to the witness stand today saying that based on that GPS, Roof traveled from Columbia to Mother Emanuel, driving by it or in the parking lot three times before that shooting. He did so in December, February, April, and then again, of course, on June the 17th. Our Karina Bolster was also inside the courtroom today. And Karina, within the last hour, we're learning more about Roof's whereabouts in the months prior to the shooting.
Lisa, in opening statements, lead prosecutor Jay Richardson said this shooting was, quote, cold and calculated. Now, in the last 40 minutes, it appears that we are learning how calculated Roof's steps were when planning this shooting at Mother Emanuel AME more than a year ago. Now, according to GPS records, the first trip to Charleston was in December. From there, the jury learned more about what happened after that, including a phone call to Mother Emanuel in February that lasted 13 seconds and several other trips to Charleston and areas outside of the city. Now, during those trips, Roof visited several plantations, including Magnolia Plantation, Boone Hall Plantation, and Fort Moultrie. He also made two specific visits to Sullivan's Island throughout the course of the 6 months. Now, in April, we did learn that Roof applied for a gun permit and was eventually allowed to buy one. So far, the timeline has showed that Roof made three more trips to Charleston after he purchased that gun. Agent Hamsky with the FBI is still on the witness stand right now giving testimony as to the timeline. And, of course, we'll update you with the latest information from that coming up next hour. Lisa?
Yeah, very long testimony from that FBI agent. Thanks so much, Karina. And also today, a representative from Walmart took to the stand saying that they had receipts proving that Roof had been to the store there in Walmart three times in the month prior to the shooting. And coming up new for you at 6 o'clock, we will tell you why the bomb squad and an ambulance were called to Dylan Roof's mother's house the day after the shooting.
Okay, who is that?
That's another lady talking. She's alive. But there's so many people dead, I think. Oh, my God.
You said there's so many people dead?
I think they're dead, yes. That last is on the way.
Okay, and I just want to make sure you're at the Emanuel AME Church.
Lisa, each of the victims in Mother Emanuel was shot at least five times. The oldest victim, Susie Jackson, who was 87, was hit at least 10 times by bullets fired from Dylan Roof's pistol. Now, we also learned yesterday in court that Dylan Roof staked out Mother Emanuel Church. He did some research on the church and found out it was the mother church of the AME organization here in the Lowcountry, the founding church. So that's the one he decided to go after. He drove by the church on several occasions to stake it out.
And had a list of several other churches as well, Bill. We're going to go to Raphael James and Miller Shealy, law professor Miller Shealy, for more analysis. Raphael?
Thank you all very much, and I hope the producers will let us go for a little while because we're getting a lot of questions online. I'm going live on my Facebook page as well as I have some for myself. I'll get started with this one. The judge has said that the sentencing phase will start in January. My question, why? Why not just go now and get it done with? Why keep them away from social media and television and magazines for that longer period of time? Why not just muscle through and get it done?
Well, at one level, it's obvious. It's Christmas and New Year. And in selecting these jurors, I'm sure it was it's difficult to get a proper jury pool for a case like this anyway. But one of the things that the judges ask when they get a jury is, do you have vacation plans or something like that? And I'm sure a lot of them, look, next week is Christmas, the week after is New Year, and a lot of people as well as the court staff have plans. And so the judge doesn't want to inconvenience the jury, and certainly the defense doesn't, and neither does the prosecution. It is a bit odd to have this long of a break, usually a day or two, but given the time of year and the situation in most people's lives, I'm not surprised that the judge did what the judge did. And candidly, at one level, the defense probably wants this because it puts a lot of distance between a lot of bad evidence and what the defense is ultimately concerned about, which is keeping him alive. On the other hand, the prosecution probably doesn't mind because they presented an overwhelming case. The only thing the jury has to think about is Dylan Roof's guilt, and it's overwhelming, and there should be no issue.
All right, now let's talk about this. This question comes to us from Lance. Is there any way that Roof representing himself can cause some sort of overturning or reduction of the verdict? Can him representing himself actually cause problems for the rest of this trial, maybe on appeals grounds?
Well, when you have a defendant like this, you know, it's a bit of a bull in the china shop kind of situation. The defendant is not a trained attorney. He is not nearly as smart as David Bruck and his defense team. And so in one sense, it's good for the prosecution in that he may not raise or argue the right issues, so they're waived for appeal. On the other hand, however, he could engage in some bizarre or erratic behavior or say something or do something outlandish, and the judge is kind of limited on how he can deal with that. So you might have something happen in the courtroom that could lead to a situation or a reaction by the court or someone else that, yes, could create an appellate issue that otherwise wouldn't be there. So he's kind of a wild card in the whole process.
Okay. Now, this time, the jury was able to come away with a unanimous verdict of guilt on all charges. What happens during the sentencing phase? Because, of course, the death penalty is a situation where not everyone agrees. It's polarizing. What happens if the jury cannot come to a unanimous decision on life in prison with no chance of parole or the death penalty?
Yes, as I understand the law, if in this case, there could always be a hung jury in the guilt phase, and so you can get a retrial. And for some bizarre reason, had that happened, he could be retried. You'd start the trial all over.
That's the guilt phase.
We're beyond that. But in the sentencing phase, if the jury cannot decide on death or life, the judge would have to impose a life sentence. So you would not have a mistrial in the sentencing phase. And that's not atypical across the country. Given South Carolina and many other states, our death penalty statute is not unlike the federal statute. It's complicated. But you don't have a mistrial in the sentencing phase. If the jury really can't decide, the judge would have to impose a life sentence.
All right.
You have to have unanimity on the death sentence.
Okay, that's something I didn't know. Thank you very much for clearing that up. We've got tons more questions, but we'll send it back to Bill and Debbie for now.
9:30 after 4 o'clock on this Thursday afternoon, in case you're just joining us, Dylan Roof has been found guilty of all 33 federal charges against him.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 17th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have commentary, observations, suggestions, thoughts you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Again, we are listener supported, counter racist radio. If you think the content is constructive, please invest. You can hit our PayPal. It's linked on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. That address is linked in all of our descriptions. When you hit the blog, look on the right side of the page. In the upper right corner, you'll see the PayPal button. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested, got things off of our Amazon wish list. Hope the program has been worthy of your time and energy. And as I consistently say, if you do not think that the program is helping you get constructive information, helping you get a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, then let's find something better to do with our time. Black people, we have serious problems, serious racist enemies that we need to deal with. We cannot waste time. That's it. A couple quick things that I wanted to touch on, and then we will get right to the callers. That segment on the term cuck. Wow. I was not going to play it. That is a lengthy interview. It was on PRI, Public Radio International. That is about a 30-minute segment that they did on the term cuck. And as I've stated before, our new most favorite race soldier, Richard Spencer of the National Policy Institute. He did the segment on NPI. He did the segment on Reveal. I played that on the compensatory call-in a couple weeks back. He was on Roland Martin. He's been everywhere. I've been saying it. Who is this guy? How is he on so many programs? But they even had him. He did about 7 minutes at the very end, and the whole 7 minutes about the term cuck and why they chose that as a term to ridicule and demean someone, particularly white men, for abdicating their duties as race soldiers. He was on there. You can check it out if you want to hear what Mr. Spencer had to say, Richard Spencer of NPI. But I was not going to play it at first because I know the Area 8 people get very excited to discuss sexual activity. I was not going to play it. And then as I continued to listen, I got about, 7 or 8 minutes into it. And as it continued, and I said, wow, this is pretty interesting. And it continued. And I said, wow, I think I'm going to have to play this as it went on. And I was only going to play about 8 minutes of it at first. And I kept listening and I was like, wow, there's no way I cannot share this with listeners. That I think I almost listened to about 20 minutes of it at that point. So I had to figure out, you know, how much of it I wanted to share with the audience today. But fascinating segment. Dr. Welsing, all day long, I thought of her theory, literally since I heard that piece just a couple days ago, over the past 24 hours, just thinking about Dr. Welsing. It is very much, that is really hitting at the essence of her theory of white genetic annihilation. In my opinion, white men and them feeling as though they're slacking on their job, they're not quite men, and particularly measuring up to black males, males who have melanin, that somehow they might be lacking in masculinity, and so they might need to do other things to compensate for that. That is all right at the core of what Dr. Welsing talked about. I again felt the enormity of not having Dr. Welsing with us. I felt that same time last week when Dylann Roof's journal was released, and just wishing she were here with us to offer her intelligence and insight on what was on those pages. Same thing that I felt for this piece. Like, I had trouble sometimes. Dr. Welsing was not into all the newfangled technology. Like, she didn't have a Twitter account and all that other craziness. So it would be difficult to like share a segment like that with her because they didn't have a transcript. So it wouldn't be something that I could easily share, but wow, I would have had to figure something out to get her to listen to that and to just, you know, hear her thoughts. That term cuck, there has been a lot of analysis. And as I've stated before, I even shared before, there was a big piece, a big write-up in the LA Times, and they even cited some other articles where they were also dissecting this term, the origin of it. When did it start being used by racist white supremacists over the last year to 18 months or so? I posted it, and they went into all of that sexual content that you just heard. They went into all of that in the written piece. So to just see this continued focus on this word and why it's become so popular, I think Dr. Welsing would have a big smile. And be great if we had a psychiatrist who has studied racism, white supremacy, who for a half century, who has been talking about some of these very issues with regards to racism, white supremacy, white masculinity, and fear of white genetic annihilation. Someone has been talking about that for about 50 years. It would be so wonderful if we had their insight on all of this. At any rate, speaking of masculinity, also, just wanted to make sure that I got in with the Dylann Roof trial this week. I thought it was hugely important. Polly Shepherd, she was one of the victims, survivors. She testified during the death row trial for Dylann Roof this week. He was convicted. She shared during her 911 call, they released the audio and the transcript and all that during the trial this week. And she said, she told the 911 dispatcher that Dylann Roof had shot the pastor, Reverend Clementa Pinckney, that Roof had shot the pastor. And then she said he killed all the men in the church. And it just really struck me as significant. It's probably one of the more significant pieces of information that's come out, at least that I've seen. In the trial, there were 9 victims total. 6 of them were black females. He shot all of the victims multiple times. But just taking that one line, that was her, you know, reaction as the shooting is going down, that he was shooting all of the men, killing 9 people in total, including 6 females, but that he killed all the men in the church. That is fascinating. If people have any thoughts on that, if other people saw that in terms of what happened this week, if people commented on that, that would be great to hear that as well. But I thought that was important, should not have been lost in the shuffle in terms of analyzing Dylann Roof and maybe even relating it to what we heard in that piece about the word cuck, Donald Trump, and white masculinity in the system of racism, white supremacy. Moving forward, one of the other things that I wanted to share, actually, this is an incident that happened to me. I rarely have stories, but I think I have a pretty good one this time. So I've talked about there's a coffee shop. It's pretty close to me. I think I could walk there pretty. I could take a leisurely stroll and be there in about 15 minutes. So I've been to this coffee shop a lot. They have great Wi-Fi. I go there frequently. I'm going to go to the coffee shop this week, and this is one of the few times, it's not an everyday thing. I have 2 computers. Normally, just, you know, I'm a victim of racism. I don't have a lot of high-tech gadgetry or what have you to get things done. But on this day, rare occasion, I have 2 computers when I go to the coffee shop. So I go in, and I'm going to need 2 tables now because I have 2 computers. And just FYI, I've been to this coffee shop so many times. I generally don't do that sort of thing, go in and just reconfigure all the furniture and what have you when I'm in public spaces like that. I'm a victim of racism. I'm a black person. So I generally try to, you know, leave things as they are, just mind my business, go about, do what I'm doing. But this coffee shop, it's smaller. I think maximum occupancy is about 65 people. It's generally not that full. Normal time, if you go in, and this was in the evening, about 8:30 p.m. Normally, if you go in at about this time, it'll be about 10 people or less, I would say. That's about average, about that time in the evening. So I go in, and again, the only reason I'm comfortable moving the furniture is because I've seen other white people move furniture around as well. If they need multiple tables or extra chairs or whatever, you know, they just want to be more comfortable in their experience enjoying their caffeine. So I get my 2 tables, and I also switch the chairs out. So I get one of the most comfortable chairs that they have in the establishment. They have 2 of these really nice, cushy, black leather chairs. Another Dr. Welsing moment. So I get one of the really cushy chairs, 2 tables for my 2 computers. I sit down. I'm about to go to work. There are other vacancies, too. It's not like I'm hogging up all the space and, you know, people are standing because I've taken all these resources. That's not the case at all. There's still empty seats available. There's another cushy leather black chair and the whole 9. So I go to sit down. And as I'm going to sit, another black male walks in. I don't know him, like, personally. He's very courteous. We speak when I see him in the vicinity and what have you. But he comes in. We acknowledge each other. He goes to sit down. He sits in the other really cushy black leather chair next to the fireplace. We're sitting about 6 meters apart, 6 yards apart, just for if you need spatial representation. You could easily park a car between us. So we're close enough that we could talk, even though we're not, but we're not that close. So going about my business. Now, there are two white women. They look like they are probably in their late 30s. They're seated at a table that is in front of kind of facing both me and the other black male. So they're seated. They're talking to each other, these two white women. And as soon as the black male sits down, gets comfortable, he pulls out his phone. I think he's texting or whatever he's doing. And one of the white women, she just looks at both of us black males. She looks and she says, wow, you all have the best setup. And she says it like all out loud. She's talking to us. And I don't say anything. That's my code. If I'm out in public and a white person, they're making it seem like they're just trying to have some casual banter, or they make a little joke like that, quote unquote joke like that, I just ignore all of that stuff. If it's not a question, they're not an enforcement officer. If I'm not, you know, asking them for something, I just ignore all of that. Plus, I have my headphones on at this point. I already have my computer set up and everything. I'm ready to go to work. So I ignore. There is about maybe about a 4-second lapse between when she says, wow, you all have the best setup, and, you know, all smiling and everything, like she's cool, she's with us. About a 4-second lapse, the black male, he giggles with her, laughs with her. The white woman that is with her, she's also laughing. About a 4-second pause, and then she says, except he, talking about me, except he took your table. Telling the black male that. Now, that's what the whole time, once that happens, that's why I said, I knew it. I knew you were just some treacherous race soldier. That's why I didn't respond to begin with. I didn't come here to joke around and have fun with you. And I just, you know, go about my business, still not saying anything. The black male, he had been laughing. He stopped laughing when she made that comment and seriously looked at her, and he asked, did that table come from this area? Talking about the area where he was seated at next to the fireplace. The white woman, she stops laughing immediately. The smile falls from her face, and she says, no. And that ended the entire exchange. I cracked up laughing. I cracked up. I'm laughing on computer number two. I'm just bent over howling with laughter. I loved it. I thought it was the best response, because I still wasn't going to say anything, but questions. I just mentioned that. I was talking with a listener this week. Sometimes asking the best question, that is the A+ optimal counter-racist response. And if you can ask the correct question, you might not need to do anything else. You might not need to say anything else. Sometimes if you can ask the correct question, that will resolve the entire situation. And I read it that this tacky, racist wench, her whole objective was to try to start conflict. She's looking at a black male. And I told one person this incident, and they said, you didn't have two MacBooks, did you? And I said, yes, I had two MacBooks. She said, oh, my goodness. Her racist mind had to be, you know, she just had to be having a total racist eruption in her mind. Like, this Negro has got two MacBooks and two tables, and then he's going to take the best chair, and then his other nigga friend is going to come in here and get the other good chair and sit next to the fireplace. I can't even enjoy my coffee looking at these nigga. But it's like, it was amazing. And just seeing that, seeing her respond in that way, and her only response is, let me see if I can get them in conflict. Let me accuse this nigga of stealing tables in the coffee shop. It was amazing. I wish I had a recording of it. And it also showed United Independent. He chose to respond. I did not. It worked out beautifully. I didn't even have contact. I didn't even say a word to him. The whole situation played out, and I didn't open my mouth other than to laugh at these white women. Amazing situation. I'll leave it at that. Last thing I wanted to share. I didn't play everything. I say every week, the audio clips that I play, this is just a sampling. This is just kind of a really a small example of the racism, white supremacy that is happening every day, all areas of people activity, all of the things that you heard, the racist comments being directed at black people online, the racist incidents in the school, all of these types of incidents are happening all the time worldwide. It is nothing special or unique. You'll see tons of reports like what I played, the racist graffiti on the black male's door where he breaks out in tears about this. This is typical. This is everyday white terrorism. And I say every week, I have lots of audio clips that I don't even play because you can't play everything. So I just try as best I can to pick things that I think would be most constructive, things that I think would be interesting, that reveal something unique that we maybe haven't heard of or thought of before. This week, I picked all my clips and I was just going to comment about one case that happened in Ohio where a white man, alcohol, firearms, ended up killing a black person. I was going to comment about it. And then I remembered that I actually did have the audio clip. And I said, well, oh, let me just, you know, listen to see if I didn't miss anything significant that would deserve this audio clip being included. This is what I almost neglected to include this week.
The last thing they say is, I didn't know it was loaded yet.
This Facebook Live video posted to YouTube and several other websites shows partygoers in 30-year-old Steve Lianis' apartment last Thursday. One person can be seen waving a gun around. Another holding a bottle of alcohol. A few seconds go by, and then 27-year-old Anthony Stanford, who was a maintenance worker at the apartment building, walks in. A short time later, he was shot. This 911 call was made.
We were playing along with the gun, and it fired, and my buddy got shot.
Leanna's told 911 he and Stanford were playing with the gun.
Who fired it? You or him?
I didn't. We were joking around with it, and
and you said the bleeding is serious?
Yes.
Leanis has been arrested on an involuntary manslaughter charge. He has pled not guilty. But Stanford's family members say they believe additional charges should be filed.
I can't accept those charges because the sentence of them charges is 4 years.
His mother says she doesn't believe Anthony would have handled the gun.
That's my boy. I kept my children out of this system of getting in trouble. I stayed on my children.
His mother says this part of the video bothers her most.
Oh, we have a black guy in the house now. Whoa. Hello, sir.
Guns, black guys. You know, it's all good.
Because they know my son's name. Why would you address him as the black guy, first of all? You know, everybody in that building knows his name, even people that just milled in the building the day before.
And she says she isn't convinced the shooting was accidental.
I've watched that video over 20 times just to make sure. I watched it not, you know, out of anger or, you know, I just want answers.
Whites, alcohol, always a horrendous combination. I think I normally say it at the conclusion to the broadcast, but in this instance, I'm going to say it now. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. With that, if you have commentary you would like to share, the number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share whatever comments you have, that would be great. I'll prompt about the time, make sure we get everybody to share their views. We have extra time once everyone has had one opportunity, then you can share whatever extra thoughts you have. And again, no metaphors for this broadcast, the compensatory call-in. First few people who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, I just want to say thanks for another week of great clips. Very insightful. I think that I wanted to say that this is Ken Steele. I'm calling from Los Angeles at the moment. And I just wanted to say that one thing that I've noticed since the election of Donald Trump is that there, to my surprise, and I don't like to be surprised on these type of matters, but I'm really surprised that there is such a desire amongst victims of racism to still insist on forgiving or absolving suspected white supremacists of any sort of culpability with respect to the actions that they perform, with the demonstrably actionable examples of racist behavior that they have displayed. I think that there is still this incessant need amongst victims of racism to typify the behavior of racists as ignorant or stupid or unknowing. And I think that this is really harmful because it puts us in a mindset where we are prone to not holding these people accountable for what it is that they're doing. So I just want to suggest that all victims of racism, when you are interpreting these acts and you are talking about what has just occurred, or you're discussing what has recently happened in terms of racism, don't describe them as stupid or ignorant, or let people write them off or their actions as such. Always make a point to describe their actions as terroristic, dangerous, threatening. And if you begin to use those terms and phrases and you begin to say this publicly, I think other victims of racism will eventually pick up on this. And another thing that I wanted to mention is that I think that these racist white supremacists are on a very, very, very sophisticated racial showcasing agenda right now. I think this week there was a number of victims of racism that were invited to meet with Donald Trump. This could have been the week before, but I don't think I've mentioned anything about this. I think they're doing this, and it's really blatant. And I think that this is just seeping into all areas of activity. And I think that many of us are getting tricked and duped by these maneuvers. I think that Jim Brown was recently saying that he fell in love with Donald Trump and whatnot because of this display. And I think that we need to be very, very, very careful about dealing with racists. I think some of us who are even noted figures in this effort to fight against racism, I think that we're being baited into having confrontations with one another on mediums that these people, that these suspected racists are controlling. And many of us are being duped into thinking that being on these outlets are somehow doing anything to damage the system that they've made. Perhaps I might be speaking to myself in some respects, but there are just some people that are victims of racism that are being baited into doing very non-constructive things with the mind that they are being constructive. And I think we need to be very, very aware of this. And I guess that's what I have to contribute for now. Thank you so much again, Gus, for this program. Oh, and also I just wanted to say regarding people who have sent me information regarding these tech positions, I'm currently in a situation where my activity is being directed towards specific projects, so I won't be open to beginning on some of these on some of your messages until after the new year. But bear with me; I will be getting to every single one of you. Thank you so much.
Grant, appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, If you have a hand up, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, good evening, everybody. This is 2812. In Virginia, I took a lot of notes, so I'm going to try to condense it. I'm actually going to watch the clock to make sure I don't go over. The Ta-Nehisi Coates interview, it annoyed me a little bit, but he is a victim. So that was some anti-blackness coming in, and so I need to apologize for that. He had mentioned a couple of different things, and I always refer back to the code book when he was speaking about President Obama. And Mr. Fuller says, do not speak and or act as if you are exercising the power of command to others when you are in truth only carrying messages from those who have the power of command. And in the system of white supremacy, the people with the power and the people that have the command are people who classify themselves as white. And I always go back to, how can you be successful in a system of white supremacy when you are being dominated? And Mr. Coates and Mr. Obama and all of us are being dominated. So whenever we're saying that we are proud, or when individuals talk about they're proud of Mr. Obama, I always put that into question. He also used words like Jim Crow and discrimination. And as Gus always tells us, those words do not accurately describe what we as black people are going through. I agree with Mr. Steele in reference to the showcasing. It's intentional, and it's just reinforcing black dysfunction specifically and confusion. It's just showing that our thoughts are all over the place, and that's just continuous. I believe it was Hannity, and Gus, correct me after I be quiet, doing the Hannity-Jim Brown thing, using words like black community when there's only one community. Hannity said something like, the government can help the black community, a.k.a. that means white people. It was just really tacky, really, really weird. He also mentioned something about having an alternative to your local school and going to a more competitive school. And what that it sounded like he was saying was that we're not going to do anything to fix the Negro schools, and we're going to try to do everything to keep you guys there, but we're not going to do anything. Also, he had to get a jab in about violence in Chicago. Go back to what Mr. Fuller says all the time. It would be great if Mr. Brown said, well, what do you suggest we do? That would be good. Also, the lack of being serious in that particular interview at the end, we're talking about preaching when we're talking about a very serious subject, which is racism and white supremacy. I found that to be very tacky and also trifling. There was another comment, I don't know who it was, it might have been Richard Spencer, or somebody had said, black stuff that gets on Venom, like Spider-Man, you got to be careful with that. That was also a Dr. Wellesley moment as well, because a little bit of imagery popped in my mind as well. And then just in reference to the term cuckold, porn is dominated by white people, period. So that just shows you where it comes from. And I just saw a lot of different words that are just being used to confuse people, just like alt-right. You just have non-white people, victims. And that's where we are. And then my last comment is just based upon all the evidence in the last clip, I am highly suspicious, but I truly believe Mr. Roof is not going to die. He's going to be alive, and I can also see a 2020 interview with Oprah Winfrey in the very near future, and I will mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
Oh, that was not Richard Spencer who made the comment about Spider-Man. We did not hear Richard Spencer at all in the audio clip, although he was interviewed in that segment on cuckold. I just didn't air it. But, that was in the cuckold piece where a different white person was mentioned in the Spider-Man segment. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, Lon should be
open. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? All right. Peace to the callers, to the hosts, and to the platform. And I just want to share real quick in the time that I have allotted some observations that I have been making about racism, white supremacy, and that I have been making about black people in general, and also Lucifer Satan, the devil, or whatever people call that. Now, during the existence of racism, white supremacy, and one of the areas of people activity being religion, I have noticed that during the existence of racism, white supremacy, and the position that black people are in, is that when it's time for us to serve justice on white supremacy or racism, white supremacy, sophisticated terrorism, we're willing, ready, and able and want to do that with all vigor and force. But I've noticed during the existence of racism, white supremacy, that if I point out something to a black person that maybe other black people do, that and that they do not want justice. And then as that pertains to the area of religion, we have certain groups of black people who, even though we're in the system of racism, white supremacy, have chose to deal with that racism, white supremacy under VGQ by saying or going under the ideology of Kemet or things that we have heard that were incorrect in religion. And I found that the fact that we have some black people who agree with incorrectness, although they're against racism, white supremacy, but it's the incorrectness that comes out of religion, so to say, or that we hear about that comes from the alleged God or whatever. And I don't mean to waste the people's time by talking about religion or God, because I understand how much we as a people, we hate to hear the word religion and God and all that kind of stuff right now. And we go and we have some black people telling our hurt, oppressed black women that the black woman is God. And so I find that although I have a lot of other stuff to do in the system of racism, white supremacy, and I want to get out of it, and we need to work to get out of it, I've discovered that stuff like this is not helping me, but is actually harmful to me as a black person, because I'm trying to do the same things that the white people are doing. So if the white people are alleging to be God and I try to act like God, how does that make me a better black person if I turn around and I'm supposed to be doing justice, but I can say that the black woman is God, or I can say that because I'm a black man, and just because she a black woman, and just because we have a black child, that I'm a god, she's a goddess, and that we some type of people to be supreme. And so I find that where religion teaches, especially Islam, teaches against the supremacy of people and talks about the supremacy of the creator, which is called Allah or the God, that this, when I make my argument against racism, white supremacy with Islam, I get black people that support me. But if I talk about when black people are supreme, or when they worship themselves as gods and goddesses, or they do some of the same things that white people are doing that we don't like, I don't have the same support. So I just wanted to share that with y'all, even though I know a lot of people may not care and give it two thoughts, but I just appreciate this show for having the ability to share that information and continue to share what I'm learning during the existence of racism, white supremacy, sophisticated terrorism. And I do believe that there are people who push for the alleged supremacy of Lucifer and Satan and the devil over anything good and over God. So that's all I have to say tonight. Peace to everyone.
Thank you for sharing your insights, sir. I appreciate that. Context of white supremacy. Do we have other folks that we have not heard from at all? Any folks that we have not heard from at all? If you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Three things. First, starting off with, captured my attention was a Chase commercial, Chase Bank, meaning commercial, that it started off with two actors, very young, a white male, black female. Couldn't have been, both of them couldn't have been no older than about 6 years old. Actually, what the commercial was depicting was some sort of long-term relationship between a white male and a black female. It started off when they were little children, very little children, I mean about 5, 6 years old. Then it got to, let's say, middle school period of time. So you're talking about another set of actors, white male, non-white black female. Then it got to high school with another set of actors. All of this is supposed to have been the same people growing up, so to speak. Never saw a commercial like this in my entire life. Then it got to the point of college. So they had induced into the commercial another set of actors, white male, non-white black female. What I noticed about the victim of racism actresses, most of them had their natural hairstyle, and all of most of the actors, the black female actors, even the starting off with the little one, the child that could have been about 6 years old. All the way up to it showed the growth all the way up to when they were quote unquote adults. And she, this actress was looked to be about in her 30s, 40s, very attractive, natural hairstyle. And the caption at the end of the commercial, the point, so to speak, what commercials have, it had on it, when you find something worth waiting for, we'll help you protect it with a long-term, because I'm looking at it on the computer.
We'll help you protect it with a long-term investment
strategy. Investment strategy, financial guidance while you're mastering, life from Chase, so you can, whatever, that sort of thing. Very interesting commercial. Anybody can get it if they want to see what I saw. Just go on YouTube and put in that Chase commercial, and this will be the first commercial that you see. Very interesting, Dr. Welsing moment type of commercial. I've never seen a commercial like this before. That was this obvious about making, other than the bank itself. Also, I think that what it really showed a message for was to suggest in a strong fashion the incorrectness of giving non-white black people a choice of having sex with white people. That's what it tells me anyway, especially a non-white person persons who are more confused about racism and white supremacy. Moving on. Two incidents related with sports / racism. I saw an interesting documentary on former high school star, University of Nebraska star, NFL, was projected to be a star, but he never did make it. And that long Lawrence Phillips, I believe his name was. The reason why this documentary was important to me is because he ran into some incidents where he went to prison for quote unquote abusing white females. He actually died in prison, and there's still a mystery on it. That's all I say on the documentary itself. From my understanding, I think it's on HBO if anyone cared to view it. There were two white females. They definitely mentioned in this documentary that he supposedly had assaulted, abused, quote unquote, that sort of thing.
that also participated in his demise. First of all, for him going to prison.
Hang on 1 second, and we'll get your other comment you wanted to share. Just make sure we get everybody in for their at least one turn.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, I'm coming this evening. First of all, I just want to say good evening to everybody. And I'm coming with a suggestion. First of all, I grew up always being polite, especially when I'm out in public. To me, my mom would go to the store. I was told to always smile and be quiet. So I grew up with that same mentality and same way of socialization. But I realized that instead of doing that, I started doing something opposite. When I would go to the grocery store, white people always like to look at you, and they'll do like this little smug smile and then turn their heads. And then it's like an almost always thing to where you always smile like back to them, and I'll just keep it moving. So I did like this experiment for like a week or so, trying to get myself not to smile at them. And some days I would mess up and I smile. But after a couple of days of being successful at it, not smiling, I found that I acquired and I held so much power that I didn't feel like I had to do anything, you know? So that's my suggestion. If we want to counteract racism in some particular way, if we have to be able to change our mindset on the things that we do on the regular every day. And that's smiling at these folks. They don't deserve our smile. And with that being said, I'll mute my line. Thanks.
Awesome suggestion. No helping white people. You can add that as well. No smiles, no helping to the best of our ability. Other people that we have not heard from at all. Did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers and the listeners. First, I wanted to talk about the commercial that the firefighter in Florida brought up, and a piece to you as well. I did see that commercial, and I zeroed in on a lot of the same things that that you discussed. It's a very interesting commercial, but it's a really strong piece of propaganda in regards to the way that it's depicting white people being the conduit for black people to get access to anything that we need via these white people who are in control of our daily reality at this point. Also, I agree, I think it was the first caller who talked about, or the second caller that talked about the use of the word community, and he was absolutely right, you know, because that term in and of itself speaks to people who live in a certain geographic area that have a common unity, or they unify around something common to them all. And black people don't have that going on. The only people that have that sort of common unity are white people, and it always surrounds the system of racism, white supremacy. So that was completely accurate. In reference to the clip with Jim Brown, and I think it was Ken Steele who discussed the fact that there was, like, I guess, an article that discussed Jim Brown saying that he was in love with Donald Trump. I saw that article, and then maybe about 30 minutes after that article came out, there was another article that said that that Jim Brown did not feel that way, and that it was actually a typo that was put out by the people who did the original article. But still, I agree with everything as far as Ken Steele's assessment of and the other black male who discussed the racial showcasing aspect of using Jim Brown and other prominent black people in a system of white supremacy to propagate a racist like Donald Trump or any other situation to further confuse black people. I thought about the clip that referenced where the guy referenced Spider-Man and the black space goo that fell on his suit and turned him into Venom, it made me think of the reverse of leprosy, because white people have always used the Christian religion specifically and Jewish religion to propagate that black people were cursed with black skin, when of course in the Torah and the biblical text it speaks of black people turning white due to leprosy. So it made me immediately think of I guess the blackening of white people via this Venom reference. So that was just very interesting in and of itself. And lastly, I just wanted to touch on something, because I was actually on another radio program and I discussed some information about Nat Turner. And one of the callers that called into that particular program actually turned out to be a blood descendant of Nat Turner. And just based on the information that I was discussing on that program that he was listening to, he actually was talking about the fact that he has a relative who is a family historian, and she wanted to put out information about Nat Turner to correct misinformation that has been floating around about him. And he also discussed the fact that there were actually two Nat Turners, which I didn't know about, and the fact that those two Nat Turners are actually confused a lot in history. So basically they want to correct the information regarding the Nat Turner who was famous for the insurrection in Virginia. And he said that the family historian wanted to get in contact with me in regards to potentially working together to get that information out there. So as those things develop, when I'm able to speak with the brother that reached out to me, I'll keep you guys posted on the developments of that. I think it's just very important, especially with all of the information surrounding Nat Turner and recently the white male who brought the supposed skull of Nat Turner to the Smithsonian African American Museum to give it to his descendants. And they're in the process of genetically testing that skull to see if it's actually Nat Turner. But this was a family heirloom, he said, that was passed down from generation to generation. And somehow he wanted to present it to his family and his descendants for them to bury the skull with his relatives. So thanks for the opportunity to speak. And like I said, I'll keep you guys posted on how that situation develops. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
Grand. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, folks. This is 1842. To the female caller who spoke about not smiling, kudos. That's something that I implemented periodically, but definitely like it's like code now, you know, and every now and then like I kind of slip up and it like comes out, but then I just, you know, remind myself I'm a victim and it'll happen again, and surely in the next 10 minutes it happens again, and I just don't smile. Even now then, I even try to get into the habit of like not being like nasty, but just even making a face like squinting my eyes a little bit, like what she's smiling at, so I have to know that this isn't okay, like not even just like a blank stare. But anyway, not to get too much into that, kudos to you. And you do feel good. I feel good when I do it. And when I practice Gus's code of when they speak to me, just not saying anything. Teaches me a lot about myself, like my own impulsivity and being programmed to respond. And it feels good when I don't say anything and like that situation ends and I'm like, I didn't say anything. Good job. Just to, you know, keep myself going. So kudos to you. I took a couple of notes. I really wish we could hear all of the clips that you have, guys. Like I really, really would love to hear all of it. Even if we didn't get a chance to talk about it, I would just love to like get all the news. But anyway, thank you for including the CRISPR information. So about that, the quote, big problems. And I wrote down a question of what other quote unquote big problems will these GMO mosquitoes solve? So if you include more, that's what I'll be kind of listening out for. Because he said that these GMO mosquitoes are going to solve other big problems in addition to the problems that they were enumerating in the clip. And then they said that they would spread diseases fast. And I was like, well, what diseases? You know, like this thing could really, really get out of hand. And the CRISPR clip highlights for me how far along the genocide slide that Dr. Welsing was talking about, like we are. Like one time she said we're on the cliff. And then and many other times I listened to her, she said the genocide slide. And I think in our minds, we don't realize that we are really, really, like, we've been on the slide and maybe even been pushed off the cliff. And with the technology that they have, this is something that, you know, could happen quickly. and we are very ill prepared to deal with it whatsoever. Like, we, you know, sometimes we think just a nuclear bomb was like the thing, but like now it's GMO mosquitoes who can spread diseases, and what that means. And so just something that I think we should be paying just a little bit more attention to, because I think it's a target us, especially when they always want to talk about malaria. So I was a little frustrated because, and then I wrote this down, that deaths from malaria are not caused from the mosquitoes alone, but by systematic oppression in all the different ways that whites have brutalized, terrorized, and just kept Africa from being able, the entire continent from being able to do whatever it is that they did to prevent malaria from being the biggest issue that it was back then, because it's a really big issue now. And so I know I'm not being as articulate with it, but you know, something as simple as having this mosquito nets, as I've heard, would prevent malaria from spreading. So we don't really need GMO mosquitoes to do that. We just need nets. And really, we don't even need white people to give us nets. We just need white people to stop messing with everybody and controlling whether or not they have the funds and the resources to spend their time and energy solving their own problems versus mining and doing all these other things and constantly having to fight, you know, white people just to be able to do basic things. So like, I don't like that, because the way that things are worded, because I feel like they're trying to play with my mind all the time. Like, no, malaria has always been a thing, but mosquitoes, GMO mosquitoes are not what we need to solve the problem. It's been solved in other places in the world. How? Because white people weren't always keeping those people from being able to handle the basic things that they needed to handle. We don't need GMO mosquitoes. And unfortunately, so many of us aren't even paying attention, but I do not trust GMO anything, let alone a GMO mosquito. Next, for the conversation with the pastor, I listened to this a lot of times in Gwen Ifill's book, The Breakthrough. When we talk about racism, I hear it all the time, quote unquote, race card is inappropriate. Like, the mind associates card with a game. It's not a game, you know? So every time that we keep saying playing the race card, playing the race card, playing the race card, we're not playing the race card. We're talking about a reality, whether other people want to acknowledge it or not. But every time, like, we use that metaphor, it just throws off the conversation. It makes it seem like this is just some trivial matter that we're addressing. And here you are, just bring, like it's a joke or something. Like, it turns the whole thing into a game, you know? And if we were going to use any game metaphor, I think chess. So whatever move we could equate might be more appropriate. But race card, it's not like a card game. And I just hear it all too often. Like, we throw it around too much. And the associations that the mind make are just, it just turns it into a game. The cuckolding, fantabulous piece. I want to listen to the entire, 30 minutes of it. And I was just a couple things. So I'm pretty sure I'm close to my 5 minutes. So by watching black men have sex with white women, I think it feeds, it's like a ritual where they can, like, watch it and then, like, feed the need to kill black men or have this aggressive feeling towards black men, like, validate all of their fears. And then he even used the term eroticized fear. And I was like, boom, okay. Oh, and then a couple of other made up words that I heard throughout the
that
format.
Is five
oh, okay,
minutes.
I'll wait. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, anybody that we totally missed, you should be with us if you have a hand up.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to just the host and to all the callers and listeners. Just a couple of things. I saw that commercial that the retired firefighter mentioned, and I just, when I first saw it, I just couldn't believe it. And it's just like Ross said, it is a great piece of propaganda, because a retired firefighter is correct when he said it's a couple, and it basically starts there in kindergarten, and you see them progress, you know, all the way up to adulthood. And then going into the bank for something. So I remember I said that. I said, wow, that is some good propaganda right there. And I mean, it's just interesting. Like you said, it's interesting. I had never seen anything like that on TV. So I can only say expect to see more of that. The interview with Jim Brown, and I guess that was Hannah too. I just cannot stand that man. But I heard Jim Brown the day after he saw Trump on the Tom Joyner Morning Show. And I remember they kept saying how the media ran to him, because when Jim Brown said, oh, I just fell in love with that man. Well, according to Jim Brown, he said it was Daryl Scott, the minister who I guess arranged this meeting. And he said that he told Trump that you know, the people need jobs. And like you say, Hannity or whoever it was throughout, you know, Chicago. And, you know, Jim Ross said he told Trump that, you know, the people need jobs. He said, because that will stop the violence and the despair. And the point is, we know that. And I remember as I heard about the meeting, I remember I said, well, if I had to say anything to Trump, it would be that, you know, we need jobs and we need that livable wage. And then I sat there and I thought about it. I said, that's not going to happen because, you know, you got a prison industry and all this stuff that's got to be taken care of. You know, the other thing with that was that Trump has a record. You know, Trump had property that he would not, you know, rent to black people. And, you know, pretty much a case taken to court. But, you know, it was like he didn't, you know, have to admit to doing anything wrong. And from what I understand, I may be wrong with this, I don't ever think that, you know, he rented any of his property to black people. So I'm like there is a record there with him and black people. And I know when he campaigned, really what he talked about with black people was what? He said at one time, law and order. And we know those code words. We know that stuff. About the word cut code, I'm just, you know, that segment, I was just like, wow. And it is, like you say, language, how the things of how they can take language and use it, I guess, in a sense, for their benefit. I saw something tonight on Facebook where somebody even said with the word deplorable, that how now they're taking that word deplorable and they're making it, I guess, something positive, you know, for them. The piece about the mosquitoes is just frightening. I mean, that's all I can say, that you have somebody in a lab coming up with these mosquitoes and what the young lady, 1842, said about malaria and stuff and just the things that these people do, because that's also a part of the destruction of your environment, you know, that you are producing a GMO mosquito in the lab. And it just kind of makes me go back to what was the problem with the Africanized bees, that the man was going to try to mate them with these, I guess, so-called American bees and got out, and then you had this great big problem. As far as the case of the guy, and I say this, then I'll get off the line, the story, I didn't know it took place in Cleveland. Remember, I'm in Ohio. I'm not too far from Cleveland. Where the guy comes into the room, comes into the house to the party, and he ends up dead, the black guy. And, the you know, his mother says, if I'm not mistaken, the piece said that he was the maintenance guy. So I'm quite sure they knew him. They knew his name. And then yet, like his mother says, oh, the black guy. That's what they're referring to him now. I'm like the mother. I don't think it was an accident. You know, some of the stuff that I heard about the story, you know, something about the gun was in the drawer in the bedroom. They get the gun out. Somebody sticks the gun in their mouth. They're playing around with the gun. All of a sudden, like, the black guy comes in and he's dead. So I don't think it's so, like you said, alcohol. And I will say this. I saw the story, you know, I was reading some of it on Facebook. And I was looking at some of the comments, and I remember this one black guy, he said, he don't mess around with white people. And he said his cousin went out, was hanging out with some white guys at a I guess, mouth of water. And he said his cousin drowned. And he said he didn't mess with white guys. And I can say I had a good friend who went spelunking with all white guys. He was the only black one. And a very good friend of both of ours said that his body came back home, but all he had gotten new equipment and everything. And my friend said his body came back home, Kim, but none of his other stuff came back home. And she just really felt that something was deliberately done. So I agree with you. Being out, you know, black people, just, I don't even care if white people aren't drinking, just being with white people, particularly, you know, when we know that their default is to hurt us. I mean, this is the stuff they live for, you know, to do things to us that literally could hurt us, that literally could get us killed. And so that is just a sad case. Of course, it's a hard lesson he learned, but, you know, the young man is dead. So with that, I'll thank you, and I'll just mute myself. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from at all. Anybody that we have not heard from at all.
May I be heard?
Yes.
Heard a female caller.
Yes,
Yes, this is Jay from Ohio. Hello to everyone. I just had 3 points to make. I think it was 1842 she was talking about, like, the GMO and not wanting to mess with it at all. I'm actually kind of researching more about that, and it was, I found it very interesting that the fact that I was watching, like, a movie on, or a documentary on Netflix, and it was about trying to be more healthy and not eat non-GMO foods, and they had a bunch of different doctors on there, and there was one, I think the doctor was Black, he might have just been non-white, and he was the only doctor on there who had to somewhat admit fault. He was saying, well, you know, I thought that it was better to just give people medicine, and then I had to end up learning that, oh, well, people can cure themselves through their food. And so I definitely thought that that was very interesting, how he basically had to show humility, and what I assume was the point of the movie was to try to get people to eat better, to live better lives. So I just wanted to point that out. Someone had mentioned something about the whole deplorable and how people are trying to take that and make it into, like, a good word. I was researching Black gun clubs, and on one of the websites, the Black Gun Club, they had an ad that was on, I think it was on Breitbart or one of those other white supremacists, what they call alt-right websites. And in the ad, I had noticed at the corner of my eye, there was, like, a picture of a white female. I think she had blonde hair, and she had on a shirt that said, that said, I was deplorable before it was cool, or something like that. It was, I was deplorable before it was fun, or something along those lines. So I definitely see that they are taking that word, and it definitely seems like, even with the segment with the cut, it seems like they definitely do, they're allowed to take words and then change the meanings of them, and that's supposed to be all right, and so forth. The last comment that I wanted to make was about the mosquitoes and how they were genetically modifying the mosquitoes. And I had, not that long ago, I had went back in the archives and listened to the medical apartheid book study, and it reminded me about when, in the book, when they were talking about they had released some mosquitoes on, I think it was a some communities in Florida, somewhere down south, I'm thinking it was in Florida, and to test them, to see how the Black residents would be affected by the mosquitoes. So it definitely doesn't surprise me that they are still genetically modifying mosquitoes to, what they're telling us is to help other people, when in the past we've seen something different. So with that, I just want to mute my line, and thank you for taking the call.
That there is why Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid is one of my top five books all time, just how frequently that book will be referenced, and it will be like a really crucial, important bit of information. Outstanding read. I heard quite a few other people spoke up simultaneously. I appreciate that, the caller that just spoke. Caller in Alabama, you want to proceed?
Yes, thank you. I just have something real short that I like to say. It's changing to the Dylan Roof case, and about how they're going to postpone, you know, the decision about his being convicted guilty after the holidays. And it just made me think about how important Black life is. How non-important Black life is, you know, that 9 people were murdered, you know, and it's going to take them all this time, you know, like, what, today is, what, the 15th, 16th, somewhere around there, I think the 16th, so, you know, Christmas is not like just, you know, it is right around the corner, but come on. You know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You know, they could decide that real quick. You know, what they gonna do? They gonna give them? I agree with the caller earlier saying that they're gonna let them live, but they could decide that real quick. I think this is very strategic, in my opinion. But I'm wrong on a lot of things. But in my opinion, I think it's very strategic. I think that they know the nationwide black people in America are looking at this case, and it could hurt their Christmas sales because black people already are talking about boycotting Christmas. And, you know, letting him live could even add more fuel to the fire for that boycott. And that's my opinion on the reason of them postponing it until after the holidays. But like I said, I could be wrong about that. And thank you for letting me make that statement. And I also like to make another statement. I think I was given the N-word tax today. I bought some food. It said $5.99 on the menu, but they made me pay $7.60. So... And they talking about, you know, I ain't going to even go into all that, but just tacky, trash, and terrorist as usual. Thank you, and I mute my line.
Wow. That is typically the experience for black people with regards to commerce. It is going to be war being waged against you at all times. Try to be as miserly as you can and be on guard. Anybody else that we have not heard from at all? I heard... Quite a few other folks.
Can y'all be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can y'all be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is 0325. Yeah, I wanted to comment on Trevor Noah actually interviewed President Barack Obama, and I thought the last about 10, 15 minutes of it was very, very, very interesting, the questions he asked him. If you haven't watched it, go take a look at the last about 10 minutes of it. Also, I wanted to point out that when President Barack Obama is leaving office, he's going to be renting a home from an NFL executive. He won't be purchasing a home. He'll be renting one from a white NFL executive. Thought that was interesting. And then also lastly, I saw an interview the other day with Michelle Obama and Jill Biden. It goes by Entertainment Weekly, and this interview was trying to make it seem as if Joe Biden and Michelle Obama were besties, you know, best friends or whatever. And it was very interesting. Michelle was wearing black, and Joe Biden was wearing white, and it was very awkward. And it just goes to show that Michelle Obama and Barack Obama, even though they're the president and first lady of the United States, they are still subject to the same racism and same terrorism that we're subject to. And with that, I'll mute my line. Thanks for all the clips you played, Gus. Thanks.
For sure. Other folks we have not heard from?
I want to call up.
Yes, sir.
I've actually been listening to your broadcast for some years, but this is my first time calling in, so I'm happy to do so. I just wanted to make a quick comment on the Jim Brown situation. I believe it was Bob Johnson who was commenting on the Jim Brown situation about him meeting with Donald Trump, and I think Bob Johnson had a very good quote. He said, you know, as black people, we should have no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests. So I thought that was a very valid point. And I think I'll just leave it at that. So, and I'll let someone else speak up. So thank you.
Right on. Good to hear. First time caller. Right on. Any other folks that we've not heard from at all? I'm just muting you because it was sound like you might be on speakerphone. Our first time caller who just spoke. So I'll unmute your line if you want to share more. Just make sure I cover everybody. Anybody that we missed completely, anybody who has not been able to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. And I've heard people touch on the Spider-Man metaphor. It was interesting because like I think you said, you got to, something is like making sure you don't get that black stuff on you, like Spider-Man and you're turning to Venom. Because I remember even as like a little kid, like just when that show was coming on, the Spider-Man cartoon show, like there's a part where he's struggling with the red gloves from his costume and the black, ooze or whatever, and he gets pulled into the black ooze. And, you know, that was coming on like 5 days a week. So it's very interesting how that person was able to utilize that. And it just goes to show how you speak on being wary of using metaphors and analogies. Because there's even characters where they'll say in video games where the evil version of the character, like his skin will be darker and his nose will be wider and his costume will turn like a dark gray. And, you know, they call him a demon. So it's like that symbolism is all over the place. And the segment from, I think, one of the firefighter was talking about, he called the black female a nigger. And I think it was a part where he was saying about her brother, I guess, was a veteran, and he was saying he didn't even care about that, because I was thinking when this all started, people were saying, well, it's about the veterans, but he was still saying he was dedicated. Like, this, hey, I don't care if he's a veteran, he can go back to wherever, and, you know, you can go out to the fields, and, you know, and I think the female that said that made the animalistic analogy about the first lady, I think that's what the comment was calling her, like an ape or some kind of primate or something. It made it seem like definitely there was pretty much codified and making sure she kept her benefits and her, and in a way, subtly rewarding her for her racist practices, because in the segment it made it seem like, well, you know, it took about 25 to 30 days to really come up with how are we going to handle this? Are we going to transfer her? I couldn't really get the gist of what they were trying to say instead of just pretty much terminating her, even though the slogan I've heard from Mr. Fuller, whites don't get fired, to get transferred. But it was like they were really wrestling with how they were going to provide her punishment, if we can call it that. And the segment about the black male getting the apology from the Trump supporter guy, like that was very interesting how they put that out there on the in the media. And I think that was a black male that said, If it was between him and the other guy, if they was by themselves, it would go the same way. It was interesting that he made that comment. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Yeah, that make sure I didn't miss anybody. Anybody that we have not heard from at all, have commentary? Anyone that we missed completely have commentary they wanted to share?
Heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Thomas Smith in New York. I have some comments I need to share. You know, those commercials where they have the interracial couples, or they're trying to propagate that type of stuff, those images, like a lot of what I see in you know, reality TV these days with the white and the black, I think it's just being used as fuel to keep the system going. I think that when we look at Obama in the White House, per se, we see a black president. And what white people see is what would happen if black people and white people mix. He's black, but he's the result of that mixture. And I think that them putting those images out there is just going to add fuel to the fire. I remember Dr. Welsen came on the show, and she said the increase in all of the gun shooting with the cops seemed to coincide with the increase of the images of the interracial couples and things on the television. So I think that's just fuel for the fire. I also wanted to add, I wouldn't put much credence or emphasis on whatever black people go meet with Mr. Trump, or the, President Trump, President-to-be Trump, because, you know, it's just a long list of presidents that they've always had black people that came out and supported them. And, you know, some people were angry with them. I think the importance of all of that wasn't that meeting. It was the fact that right after that meeting, he met with all of the tech giants and all the people that were pretty much against him during the election. Now they're all at the table. And I said on the show a long time ago that the most dangerous white man in the world right now is Elon Musk. And he's building the Skynet. You know, that's the computers, that's the robots that's going to be walking around. And the fact that he got that meeting, in the meeting afterwards, him with some of the other people that are very prominent in building that with him, I just found that to be the most interesting news topic. But, of course, the news will focus on one thing, get everyone talking. But the thing that you should be focusing on is happening, but they're not going to pay too much attention to it. So I think that was the meeting with Jim Brown and Kanye West was just a diversion to hide the fact, or not to hide it, but just to draw the attention away from the fact that he was meeting with the tech giants, who seem to be the only people that can go out of space these days. I mean, they have a lot of power. And, you know, from there, I'll just leave it at that. I think everyone touched on everything that pretty much happened with the clips that I was able to hear. I was traveling here at the Plantation/hospital. And, I mean, the racist stuff that happens in here, I try to forget because it lingers, you know, like it's really depressing. And I find myself being depressed doing this job because of some of the things, especially when I'm working in the ER with the treatment of our people and the condition our people are in as a result of white supremacy. It's just so astronomical that it's like almost like I had a little bit of hope and it's slowly fading away. I mean, it's just that dire when you see what comes into the emergency room. It's really tragic. I mute my line. Thank you.
Protect your black mental health. Very important. If you know what you're saying every day is having that strong of an adverse impact on you, which I am sure it would. Are there folks we have missed, like anybody we have not heard from at all who has a hand up?
Matt, you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus, and good evening to the listeners. I just want to cover a few things based on the earlier segments. The CRISPR genetic manipulation technology, you know, that's always been one of my fears of racism, white supremacy slowly coming to fruition. You know, once they have intellectually stifled black people and made sure that we are not on the scientific frontier of anything or even scientifically interested, they're at their leisure now to get into genetic manipulation, and they've been wanting to do that forever. Yeah, that's just, you know, super soldiers and controlling people through genetics and, you know, enhancing themselves, you know, due to their lack of appreciation for themselves. I think technically they've always been so self-hating, but very deceptive and very good at projecting that self-hate onto other people by making other people ugly or suggesting that other people are lesser and inferior, and, you know, in hopes of enhancing themselves. But, you know, once they get a hold of you know, genetic manipulation, it's going to be considerably more difficult to overcome this problem. And so with that in mind, you know, I think if you can find it within yourself as black people, not white people, but really taking maybe some sort of an interest in a scientific approach, physical sciences, biological sciences. You know, I think that's going to be in high demand right now in order to solve this problem. But anyway, you know, the white friends thing, I don't know. I've been listening to the program for about 6 or 7 years now, 6 years, I think. And this white friends thing keeps coming up for particularly the more confused individuals. You know, that white friend and the damages it does. There was the unfortunate victim in Texas who his white friends, it was said, drug him around Texas and you know, killed him horrifically. You know, white friends that are, you know, practicing with nooses on black people, white friends that are drowning black people, you know, on boats, on the water, white people around water. Me and my friends, we've always had that, like, as the number one thing to not do if supposedly you find yourself around white. I don't play with white people in boats and water, and they mix alcohol into that. I know 4 drownings of black people around white folks. So, you know, white friends is dangerous enough, but for the more confused, I just wouldn't find myself in a position to be around many white people calling them friends, and especially with the alcohol. I listened to Donald Trump thank you rally speech in Alabama, and he is promising a whole heap to his supporters. My perspective, you know, I guess I would say, I don't know if anybody's listened to it, and you know, just the kind of language he's using, how he's just gonna help the guy on the bottom and bring them up, and he's gonna restore all their jobs, and he's gonna bring the manufacturing back, and he's promising a whole heap, and he's promising all of this to people, you know, so-called disenfranchised racists, and they seem to be believers in him. Supposedly, these polls keep suggesting that, you know, yeah, everybody, all of his supporters are waiting for him to come back and restore the good old great America, making it great again. And I just see a tremendous calamity when these things don't start working, because, you know, they were totally relieved that, you know, Obama's out, and they complained for 8 years about him. And then Trump comes in and he's, you know, the great white wonder and hope for these people. And when they don't get what they want, it's bad enough that we can, that the amount of terrorism that non-white people, black people undergo regularly, daily, is as high as it is. And that's even before Trump was in office. And if he gets in office and he doesn't do this stuff, you know, I'm thinking this purge thing, so-called race war, so-called, actually turns out to be race riots. When they don't get what they want, and he failed too, and it doesn't work out, and he's put all this cabinet together, and they're doing all this stuff. So, you know, just from that perspective, just my warnings, please get your gun game up, get your hunting skills up, get your survival game up, really start being warfare-like yourselves, warrior-like, because it's just, you know, I don't think, unfortunately, we can spend too much time being too depressed. We have to be active and on the consistent grind, making sure that we can, you know, can cover ourselves under these conditions. And that's it. I'll be my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, man. Is there anyone that we missed? Anybody that has not been able to comment at all? Grand. We have about 25 minutes, so if you have not dialed in, do not wait until the last minute. That is the most nerve-plucking thing ever. Sorry, my apologies. It is not helpful in efficiently managing a broadcast when people should know the schedule by now. So if you think you want to share, don't wait till the last moment. Go ahead, dial in. See, 1842, you said you had additional comments?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I do. So, about the cuckolding, pardon me, I was slightly running around. Okay, so the last thing I was able to say was, by watching black men have sex with white women, it's a ritual that they're able to. Can you still hear me like this?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Okay. By watching black men have sex with white women, it's a ritual, and it kind of like feeds the white male's mentality, because it's one thing to say, I bet you more white people are watching cuckolding porn than are necessarily participating in it or talking about it. So if someone was to give me a statistic, I would just expand it more to include those who are voyeuristic in it or consuming it in some other fashion. But anyway, it would serve a purpose. And these are all speculations, just like thoughts I'm having, would serve the purpose of reinforcing the eroticized fear of white genetic annihilation. But they're able to like watching sports. I know we're not supposed to use metaphors, but I'm not exactly sure how else to explain this. Enacting something that you can't necessarily participate in, or you do participate in, and it fuels you and carries you on so that you can keep practicing terrorism against black people. Another speculation is that it's a way for, like, for those who participate in it, it's a way for white men to have sex with black men. So if black men have sex with that white woman, then that white male has sex with that white woman. In a way, he's having sex with that black male. I could be totally incorrect, but just like, why is this a thing? Because I'm new to knowing about this. So when I first heard about it was in the article that was posted, or maybe someone even said it, but it wasn't, I haven't been privy that long. So I'm just trying to figure out, well, what is it with this? And then one thing is like, the person speaking about it, that guy, I kind of disagreed with why he was saying it was so, that it's like the why that the alt-right, quote-unquote alt-right, is using the term cuckold or cuck as a way to say that you're a race traitor. I guess that might be one interpretation, but I kind of read it based off of how the word evolved, that it's when they say weak white men, and that is men who get effed by black people. And men who get effed by black people would be men who get taken advantage of. And then I would take away men and just put white people. So, like, you're a cuck, if you are all the things that he listed, like Black Lives Matter or acknowledging racism and all those such things. So that, like, yes, you're a race traitor, but like in these other undertones, being taken, quote unquote, being taken advantage of by black people. And so, like, yeah. And then he said that there's no such thing as a white race. I don't know if that's doublespeak, but it's a lie. I just wrote lie next to it. There's only one race, and it's the white race, and they made up a race. So now, like, in addition to reverse racism, there's this whole notion that there's no white race. And no, so I just wanted to point that out. That's absolute lie. And then I'm just fascinated by how many words they always make up. Like, white people stay making up words. I know it wasn't a white person that said this one. Mr. Coates, if I'm saying his name incorrectly, forgive me. Otherizing. Who came up with otherizing? and then kinkster, racialized kinks, eroticized fear. I was like, they just keep coming up with terms over and over and over again. And it's just like, it's too much, in my opinion, because you're unable to speak clearly and directly to a problem, or to come up with any solution that is clear and succinct. And I'm good with that. I just wanted to finish off that. I do, if you could post that whole thing or tell me where I could get that whole thing, that'd be fascinating, because I definitely think there's something to these white men, what, like, enjoying black men having sex with their white females. And that might even be something too with the rise in interracial. Like one would say, well, if things are so bad, why do the commercials have all these interracial relationships? Why do TVs have all this interracial relationship? There must be something to white people watching other white people rape, essentially, like in the context of white supremacy, rape black people, and then have terms for it. All speculations, just thoughts. I can be totally incorrect, but thank you for letting me share.
Retired firefighter, you said you had additional comments you wanted to share, sir.
Yes, I can. There was one more incident involving quote-unquote gang rape at the University of Minnesota. Now, there's a lot of ifs with that because it wasn't brought out, at least to me, on whether or not the female victim was a white person or a non-white black female. I don't know. Maybe somebody else knows. And I can't be sure, and I could be wrong, but I'm almost pretty sure that so-called assailants, probably were black males, being that on most of these Division I teams that are pretty good, it normally requires black males to be on the team. I did find it unusual that the quote unquote spokesperson was a white male team member. There's a lot I don't know about that particular story. Maybe somebody else can go into it more and find out more of the facts of it as far as that concerned. That was the only thing that I was going to mention about was that particular case. Thank you.
For sure, that University of Minnesota situation is interesting. I suspect more information will come out of that case. From what I read, the local enforcement officials, they chose not to charge. They said they had a lack of evidence to charge anyone in the case. Alcohol was involved in that case too, and the same thing from the information I saw, they didn't give the racial classification of the accuser. But it sounds, just from what I read the details, that there were 10 players total suspended, all black males. The white female said that she had consensual sexual activity with more than one of the males, but there were just other males that she had sexual activity with that she did not give consent. And then the alcohol kind of distorted some of it. Just the whole scenario to me sounded very much like, I suspect this could be a white woman, but again, they didn't charge. I don't know. That might not be the case. And there's more to come. And the players might even have a suit because they were saying that they felt this suspension was incorrect because the school's internal Title IX investigation has not concluded. So the players felt that their was something incorrect about a punishment being given out when the investigation has not reached a conclusion, from what I've read.
It was reported that they ended the boycott for some reason. I saw that today. I think on Yahoo that took place. One more quick thing. I was surprised to know that someone else other than myself makes a conscious practice not to smile back at white people. That's similar to the handshake thing that white people do to try to get your approval of their mistreatment and or tacky, trashy, or terroristic behavior. So they stick their hand out. But also with the smile thing also. That's a kind of like a situation to coerce a black person to confirm them being white and incorrect. And I do make a practice that I do not smile back. But so kudos to the caller who acknowledged that. Thank you.
Couple quick notes I wanted to make sure I share as well, and then folks have other commentary they want to get in before we conclude. We should have time to include that also. Caller in Michigan. Number one, during the Ta-Nehisi Coates interview, I don't know if people read his article, My President Was Black, past tense. I don't know if people read it. It was pretty large. That might be something to discuss down the road as well. From that interview, I don't always agree with Mr. Coates. Some listeners took Gus to task because I was critical of his book that came out last year. I felt there were a lot of metaphors and it just wasn't as accurate about white people's commitment to racism, white supremacy. But that notwithstanding, in that interview on NPR, I thought it was great when he used the term white supremacy. At least he started correctly when he said he felt President Obama underestimated white supremacy, even though I do not take that position. I appreciated that's the way that he phrased it, not underestimated white privilege prejudice or any of these other euphemisms and pussyfooting around it. Be direct. She changed his term from President Obama underestimated white supremacy to, so you're saying that certain racist tendencies in our culture, that is a very different thing from what Mr. Coates originally said. That's one of the ways that they practice racism, white supremacy. They're not going to use those terms. And if you notice, the pattern is going to be consistent. It's going to be 10 times out of 9. That's the way I meant to say it. That it's going to be a change that is less clear, less direct, less explicit than what you originally stated as a non-white person about racism. That's what you're going to see. I also thought it was important when the same white female interviewer, when she tried to get him to talk bad about black people, what about those 8% of the black people that voted for Trump? And he just came back like, I think it's much more accurate to talk about the massive chunk of white people that, like, yes, yes, standing. No metaphor. I was extremely pleased. A+ black self-respect. That sort of tackiness, the same reminded me of the tacky white wench at the coffee shop. To just bring 8% of black people? Really? Are the 8% of, are they responsible for Trump being in the White House? Like, come on, man. And that should be interpreted as an act of racism. They always do that. Whatever it is, we got to find some way of blaming niggers for everything. That piece about Cuck, when they said that monogamy was privileged, and even talking about the whole concept of being a cuck or a cuckold, I felt it was inaccurate. If you're going to have that discussion and talk about how a lot of this is about having a big buck black male come in and have sex with your wife and exclude slavery from all of that, I think that is missing the point. I thought it was when they talk about having some sort of reverence for monogamy, my mind went back to the enslavement of black people as well. You can be married. Thomas Jefferson and these folks are married and still go out and rape black females, black children that are enslaved, black males. You can be married and still go out and do this. There's less scholarship, but the scholarship does exist that black females were participating in this raping. So I feel like just all of the sexual deviance and racism and sexual deviance of whites, it extends centuries. It's not a new thing. This is a part of the bedrock in terms of white culture and just things that they do. It's worldwide in terms of these sort of activities, this sort of behavior. Also thought when they were talking about the dude on the corner, I was reminded of the spook who sat by the door, Sam Greenlee, because we just read it and he has a really eloquent passage where he talks about the frustration of the very black people in Chicago that Sean Hannity mentioned who got frustrated and now they just sit out on the corner and shoot dice and drink alcohol all day long. They did this because they saw what happened to the people that tried to go, the black people that tried to go to school and do well and went to college and got all spiffied and cleaned up and went out to get a job and just got rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection, or got a job. And then, as he stated in the book, got their nuts cut off. I'm using the metaphor because that's exactly what he said. In Chicago, no less. Spooku said by the door. But yeah, I was reminded of that immediately. There is a process, and I'm sure Ta-Nehisi Coates, he knows that process, but there is a reason those black people ended up on that their corner. I also thought Kink, how did I leave that out? Man, that whole report, just paying attention to the words that white people use is amazing. For that whole report, I kept thinking, so you describe what you call deviant sexual activity, use the same term to describe that people use to describe the hair of people with melanin. That is fascinating. We've talked about that on before. And in fact, I would have just read the word guide where Mr. Fuller talks about the word kink and gives his just same thing, talking about that is fascinating. We should think about that a little bit more, maybe. Why do you use the same term? Because that was what I, every time, he kept saying it. That's what you use to describe black people's hair, and that's what you use to, that we're supposed to straighten out and get rid of and feel bad about. And then that's the same term that you come back and use to describe sex that nobody should be engaged in, but which is all over the place. Same thing with, you come right back to the cuckold thing. And just all of the work, just paying attention to all of the terms that they used. I thought it was extremely important in 1842 when they said fears are often eroticized, which is fascinating. And going back to Dr. Welsing, fears are often politicized, going right back to Dr. Welsing with all of this and the fear of white genetic annihilation, which I think is underwriting everything that was mentioned in that clip. And I think I can stop. Oh, wait a minute. Even the bondage and everything, even that goes back to racism, white supremacy, don't you? And I've heard Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing talk about this, where you have white men dress up in black leather and ask to be whipped and chained. Who would do such a thing? Why would you do such a thing? So you have white men who literally go out and do this to black people and then have fantasies about, that's even in Roots. I'll stop there. That's even in Roots, the original one. That's even in Roots. I'll stop there. Other folks have anything they wanted to share before we wrap up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
A few things. One, I've spoken to some suspected white supremacists regarding the word kink and the association with black hair. And, you know, they all play very coy when this is brought up, of course, which is to be expected. But they describe the word, and I've heard multiple suspected white supremacists in multiple contexts describe the word kink in the sexual context, referring to, I guess, a metaphor about knots and their sexuality being all sorts of knotted up kinks that get, I guess, twisted by society, and it's all knotted up. And I guess that's how they described it, and I guess that's why you don't talk about, why you explicitly say do not use metaphors in this conversation, simply because, yeah, it's all very confusing, it's not very illustrative, and when you do, and I just want to say for the record, yeah, when you do ask a suspected white supremacist about the word kink and its association with black hair, they consistently, from my experience, will just deny any sort of association with it. Also, yeah, you are correct. None of this is new. None of this is different. But what I do suspect is happening is that producers of pornography are, for a time, made it top of their agenda to produce coupled pornography. And this was, I guess, a big fad, which I've noticed has been overcome by what seems to be incest porn. That seems to be what trends on all the tube sites for, you know, regardless. And it's really ridiculous when you see they even have interracial incest porn, which doesn't even make sense to me. But that's what they're doing right now. So I think that is what is going on with respect to that word and its propagation. I just saw that the theme and the motif of cuckolding was for a time just being overrepresented in the production of a lot of very popularized porn sites. And then also I wanted to say the caller earlier that was talking about how I just covered that, how all of this is just covered. Yeah. Anyway, that is my contribution at the end of this broadcast. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings to you, Gus. Thanks for allowing me to speak again. I just wanted to read the title of an article that I read earlier, and it kind of speaks to what's going to be done to our children. It says, the disturbingly accurate brain science that identifies potential criminals while they're still toddlers. And I just want to read the first paragraph, and that's it. Scientists are able to use brain tests on three-year-olds to determine which children are more likely to grow up to become criminals. It sounds like Minority Report come to life, an uncomfortable idea presenting myriad ethical concerns. But though unnerving, the research is nuanced and could potentially be put to good use. So that should be enough to help you understand where they're going with this. Also, I wanted to touch on the Dylann Roof clip and the fact that one thing that's really disturbing is that in reference to Reverend Pinckney, I find it very telling that they're ignoring the fact that he's a senator and the fact that he should not be referred to as a murder victim, but a victim of an assassination. And I think throughout this entire situation, that has been downplayed, and I think it's been downplayed purposefully so that no one is focusing on that as the reality of what was done and the fact that he could have also been sent there to actually assassinate Reverend Pinckney and decided to take them all out at the same time because, of course, he's a racist white supremacist. Also, I wanted to touch on the fact that the GMO mosquitoes are exactly what caused the Zika virus in the first place. So GMO mosquitoes, what they claim is the Zika virus, GMO mosquitoes have been around for a little while now in regards to that. And to me, this is just like the second wave of genetically modified mosquitoes that they're planning or have actually put out. And I believe it was in the Florida area in regards to supposedly combating Zika. But I think it's just going to mutate other illnesses and cause issues for the non-white people in that area of the world down in the Florida vicinity and those surrounding states. Thank you, and I'll meet my line. Oh, also, I wanted to ask us if you can email me a link to the full 30-minute clip of the cuckold clip, because I wanted to actually look into that as well. And also, I was going to say that that's the origin of porn. That really is the origin of porn, is them forcing black men to have sex in front of them and enjoying the fear mixed with the sexual activity that they were able to bear witness to. It's just an upgraded version of that, in my opinion. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
You can, but we have done our 3 hours. I will see if I can get through our announcements tomorrow. If you can get it in 30 seconds, be brief. But we have a program tomorrow. We'll be here tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central, and 12 noon Pacific. We will have our Global Sunday Talk on Racism. We should have victims of white supremacy from different parts of the globe on the program. We will get thoughts on the close of 2016. Probably try to get some of our international listeners, if they've been hearing about the Dylann Roof trial, as that's been going on. There were some really good, some of our UK listeners, there were some very interesting documentaries on the BBC over the last month. They had one, Black is the New Black, where they had all of the well-known Black Britons, Naomi Campbell, and quite a few other, Alicia Dixon, Thandi Newton, Cowbell, quite a few. Oh man, that was one for Naomi Campbell too. But quite a few Black Britons talking about their experience with racism, white supremacy, very honestly, how they were terrorized by whites and things that happened to them, trying to buy houses, advancing their career, dealing with enforcement officials. It was really interesting. And they also had one on Mark Duggan, who was a Black male cowbell as well, who was shot and killed by police in 2011, led to days of what they call rioting in London and even throughout England in August of 2011. They had a great documentary on that as well. So we'll probably talk about some of what came out of those projects also. In addition to the holidays, they've been having the annual Black Pete is Racism protests in the Netherlands. It'll just be quite a bit to cover, but that's tomorrow. And then we should be here during the week, just trying to get the confirmation for program times and schedules. If you have a problem, if you can't find something in the archives, if you shot an email and did not get a response, because I know sometimes the messages either end up in spam or whatever, just feel free to drop another line if I missed or didn't get back to you. Or if you just have a question and you have not been able to ask before, feel free. If you have a guest suggestion as well, or if you're confused and just need info about something that was discussed on the program, feel free. UntilJustice@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at UntilJustice, Facebook as well. Facebook page is, for me personally, The Problem is White People. That's what it is on Facebook, facebook.com/TheProblem. Is white people. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. War is being waged against us. Let's make sure that our behavior reflects that at all times. I do not think being under the influence of alcohol, tobacco, cigarettes, cannabis, anything else that racists provide, I don't think that's going to help us neutralize Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any of these other whites, race soldiers, badge or no. Sobriety would be best. The caller that spoke up, can you get your comment in about 20 seconds, or do you need more time than that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. I would just like to say that racist white supremacists, sophisticated terrorists worship Lucifer, and that they love the slander of what we know or hear as God or Allah, and that they spend a lot of money for that, and that pornography is idolatry and a form of Luciferian content at its base. Unlawful sexual intercourse. That's all I want to say.
Grand. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.